Have you looked at the Boba Fett underoos lately?
Long ago, in a galaxy far, far away, the Star Wars saga began, and Kenner continues the excitement.
Star Wars figures.
The Empire Strikes Back, Return of the Jedi.
Welcome to the Star Wars Collector's Archive podcast. It's the Cive Cast. Newest news on the oldest toys, from bubble bath to belt buckles. 12 packs to 2 packs.
New boss, alien bounty hunter.
From the Star Wars collection.
Watch out, Vader!
We bring the world of vintage Star Wars memorabilia alive with informative features and personal collecting stories.
Offer expires December 31st,
1979. An R2-D2 with
sensor. The Supreme Master, the Emperor.
Brought to you by the Star Wars Collector's Archive. The SWCA.com. With your hosts, Sky Payne,
Steven Chewbacca,
and Steven B. Deadly. November's Kivecast Vintage Pod is unlike any other, because the recent news of Disney buying Lucasfilm in episodes 7, 8, and 9 was just too big for Steven Sky to handle alone. So we called in the big guns and created a roundtable of vintage Star Wars star collectors from our very own Star Wars Collectors Archive. We got Gus Lopez, Chris Jorgulius, Ron Salvatore, and Tommy Garvey. We're all talking about the potential ramifications of the new movies on the market. We discuss what it means to become Disney-fied and reminisce about the announcement of Episode 1 in the mid-90s. But that's not all, folks. We keep the round table circle as we discuss the figure of the month, none other than the Fett Man himself. Are you ever curious about how the Rocket Fett got its name? About how many of them are there? About how they became worth in excess of $20,000? About how they were found in Cincinnati? All of these questions will be answered by our panel. We also have a buy nugget and a multifactorial unloved section. All this, plus about as much Dash Rendar, Sayo Bibble, and Dr. Alan Grant news as you could possibly take on the Kivecast Vintage Pod Super Mega Cast Roundtable. Wampa Wampa.
Welcome to the Kivecast Vintage Pod for November 2012.
That's right, Steve. It's just been a crazy month. I've got all this work to do, but we're really excited because this is the month of the whole Disney and Episode 7, 8, and 9. And how are we going to celebrate that, Steve?
With a true Knights of the Round Table discussion.
That's right. So we got this whole plan, and we'll give a little bit more information once we kind of get to the break. Yep. But, Steve, you know, I believe in tradition, and so we at least have to get to the movie thought, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Well, my first of all movie thought is, you know, Boba Fett is just blessed in this hobby.
Yes, he is.
Because, you know, he's always got the premium. Everyone always thinks he's the coolest. Even your very own co-host rated him the coolest figure in the history.
I know. It was a shocker.
And then it's his month out of all the months that had to be when episodes 7, 8, and 9 were announced.
Yep, he got pushed right out of that spotlight.
Yeah, but still, it's like he gets married to this concept. You know what I mean? That, like, this was the month of Fett is also probably the most exciting month in the history of the Kivecast, you know?
Yeah, man, no doubt.
But my whole point, and this is not, you know, I thought of this before I ever heard anyone else say it. But other people have said it, Steve. But I remember thinking this very distinctly when I was about 13 years old.
Okay.
And that is that Boba Fett is not a good bounty hunter.
Hmm. How so?
He just isn't. I mean, what does he do, right? Like, he doesn't
I mean,
even...
yeah, if you go by his screen track record, he doesn't really bear the
I mean,
the strength that you would hope with all the hype.
Okay, so even if we accept the special editions, right?
Sure, yeah.
Greedo does all the hard work. Greedo's the guy who gets shot. Greedo's the guy who finds him. He just stands there, looks cool, puts his hand on his gun. That's about it. Then you go to Empire. Okay, he does a pretty good job of hiding. But then he doesn't even capture them. He gets Vader to capture them for him. And then he lets Vader do whatever he wants to him. And then he puts him on the ship like he did it himself.
Oh, yeah. Taking all the credit.
And then he spends his whole life just hanging out at the court, you know, nodding, being cool. And then, you know, of course, you know, his famous death scene where he screams and he sounds like a sissy. So, I don't know. I remember thinking that when I was 13 years old because he was my favorite character, you know, just when I was six or whatever because he was so mysterious and cool.
Right.
But I think that's kind of I think that's a good metaphor. And I think if there's any young women out there listening to us, Steve, which is unlikely, but if there are...
I'll say wait for the crickets.
Yeah. If there are, you know, often the guys who seem like they're just so deep and just quiet and, like, just so cool and handsome, like, you just think if you'd only get to know them, you'd learn that they're just so amazing and profound. But most of the time, Steve, they're just kind of dumb.
Oh, man. Well, see, I might fit into that category.
Oh, no, Steve, you're not cool. Come on.
I'm not as cool as Boba Fett, but...
Steve, no, I'm just kidding. Actually, you know, before we get to the conference call, my brother, Amos, he doesn't collect, you know, but he collects a little bit, but yeah. He listens to the show just because he likes it.
Oh, hey.
And he is your number one fan, Steve.
Wow.
Yeah.
Number one fan. Awesome. Yeah,
no, like, he, like, can't wait to talk to you. He's already talking about when am I going to come on the show and stuff.
Oh,
and,
sweet.
And he's always like, I don't know how he puts up with, like, he's like, I wish I could talk to someone as cruelly as you talk to Steve. So, anyways.
Oh, man.
Do you have any trumping thoughts, seeing as you completely whooped me with the power droids?
No, man. I figured that was my walk-off.
right.
I'm never going to take the bat again with the movie thoughts. No, I'm just kidding. Actually, give me one second. I did have one back,
okay.
When I was reading the Empire script, there's a description of Boba Fett that I was going to read.
Okay.
Give me one second. I'll pull it up.
Yeah. While you're bringing that up, I think that I might have to come up with some kind of drop for, you know, Steve's script reading or something.
yeah, it was something I've been thinking about because these early drafts have some just pure gems of information. One second. Almost got it.
Let's see, how would it go? Would I get, like, the sound of, like, papers flipping or the sound of a librarian?
Okay, here we go. So this is in Leigh Brackett's original. She was the first screenwriter that was working on Empire. But this is a handwritten note that Lawrence Kasdan put on her typed script. So he just goes by Boba. They don't actually fill out, say, Boba Fett.
Okay.
And right next to the name... Kasdan wrote in parentheses, a very tough customer with an arrow pointing towards it. So that's just pre-selling this whole badassness that never really substantiated.
Right. A very tough customer. That's awesome.
Yep.
All right, Steve. So let's explain what's going to happen here. We are going to have a normal episode. We are going to talk about, we're going to have all the normal sections, but we're going to do it in a different way.
Yep.
Now, don't fear for episode 35 with Bossk, my mortal enemy. Everything's going to go back to normal with just you and me and maybe a little bit polyvocal.
Right.
But just with this news, it just seemed to me that we should get not as many people as possible because there's lots of people I wanted to invite on, but it would just be too many people. You know, it would have been great to have Duncan on there. It would have been great to have Brock, you know, some other people on here.
Yeah.
But what I thought was, well, why not just talk to someone like the oldest, schoolest collectors that I know, and people who are really affiliated with the archive, because the other thing is this news about the new movies, it's just completely energized the Star Wars fandom.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And that applies to podcasts, too. Now, if you haven't tuned out already, which I imagine you might have when I started saying that Steve wasn't cool, you know, like for instance, a good example is, you know, the Forcecast. You know, like, I always listen to their roundtables for the Clone Wars, but I'd say I listened about one out of every four of their weekly episodes.
Okay.
You know, I've been listening every week ever since the announcements. It's so exciting, you know, and, like, I remember why I liked them so much in the first place. And, you know, same thing with This Week in Star Wars and Star Wars Action News. Like, I'm, like, listening to more than one podcast again, and it's just – it's really exciting. So I'm thinking there may be some people who are like, hey, what is the vintage reaction? So I thought it'd be great to get sort of vintage luminaries and us.
Yeah, that's a good way to describe them.
Vintage luminaries and us to talk about it.
Yeah.
And it'll be interesting, Steve, because I've never done a full roundtable before. I was inspired by this. The Forcecast did a roundtable to their reaction. So I like to acknowledge when I copy their ideas. and I'm going to try and copy the host because he does this cool thing where, like, he'll ask a question and he'll say the person's name right ahead of time. Mm-hmm. And it keeps it really mellow. So you may hear me do it and it'll sound kind of inauthentic, but that's just because, you know, I'm an amateur. But without further ado, Steve, we are going to hit the news, so to speak, and then we will have a discussion about Disney, about 7, 8, and 9, and then we're going to talk about Boba Fett, but just with this whole table of well-known collectors, you know, Gus Lopez, Ron Salvatore, Chris Georgoulias, and Tommy Garvey.
The Knights of the Vintage Collecting Roundtable.
That's right. I still haven't come up with a better name. I was like, should we call it the Space Chess Table? That's not funny. I thought, like, I wish there was a name of the table in Empire, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Where they were sitting. But, yeah, and all of that. And next month, Steve, we'll have to talk about you going to Rancho Obi-Wan.
Oh, yeah.
And we'll have to talk about the first meeting of the Empire State Star Wars Collectors Club.
That's right.
We'll have to talk about Angry Birds.
Mm-hmm.
But for now, let's talk about 789.
Watch out!
It's Kenner's News. It's Kenner's News. It's Kenner's News.
Here's the news. It's Kenner's News. The news from Kenner.
All right, Steve, so here we are with everybody, right?
Yeah, we got the whole crew.
All right, and I think you and I are going to do the least talking if we play it off right. But I'm not going to, I'm going to do sort of like my official introduction. I'm going to try not to have it sound like I'm introducing a basketball game. But let's see here. So from Orlando, the keeper of the Hobby History Archive, the world's biggest Kia Mall fan, Disney and Zelda enthusiast, Tommy Garvey.
Joy we all can share.
How's it going, Tommy?
Pretty good, Sky. How about you?
Going great. And from North Carolina. You see, that's impossible. See, I just got to do the Jordan thing when I say from. I played too much Space Jam pinball. Okay. From North Carolina, the man who must be named. It's Chris Jorgulius. You there, Chris?
Hey, guys, Steve.
And from the shadows of West Point Academy, on the muddy banks of the Hudson River, the man whose archive write-ups set the standards for writing about toys with wit, clarity, and other stuff for the entire internet. It's Ron Salvatore.
Hey, Sky.
Did I go too far in these, Steve?
That's all right. Just let it roll.
Yeah, you gave me 10 minutes in between the last part we recorded and this part, and I just sort of went off. And finally, broadcasting from the Boba Cabana, found high atop the tippy-tippy top of the Seattle Space Needle, Star Wars author, Star Wars Collectors Archive founder, and rancid serial donator, Gus Lopez.
Gus!
Hey, Sky, Steve, how's it going?
All right, it's going great. So, we're here to talk about a couple things. First, we're going to talk about this crazy news. You know, when I heard about Disney and I heard about 789, I thought, you know, this needs more than just Steve and I sort of blabbing about it.
Yep.
We need to get, like, the voice of, you know, the vintage intelligentsia, right? Yeah. I can we move that into one word, Ron? You're pretty good with words.
Is it an intelligentsia?
Yeah, you guys are intelligentsia, right?
Okay. You say so.
and because of that, I'd like to make the first decree. I don't know if you guys can agree with me on this. Well, it's my my second favorite April Fool's joke in the history of the hobby. Jeffrey Hunter, who we all know has a great sense of humor, posted in April 1st, 2005, that at Celebration 3, the post-quills will be announced. And what do you guys think? Is that as funny as I think it is, Gus?
You know, in hindsight, it's brilliant. You know, it's very funny to see it now. I get a kick out of seeing it tonight. Like, I was like, wow, oh yeah, that was really prophetic.
Yeah,
and I hope he doesn't announce like a sequel to the holiday special.
Yeah, exactly. I love the idea that, you know, because there were sequels, right? I mean, the sequel was like Empire and Jedi, and that, you know, so these are the postquels. So, anyways, that's at least what I'm calling them. I don't know about you, Steve.
I'll stick with it for now, but I may have to change as time moves on. I don't know.
It'll be hard to fight calling them the sequels. But main thing I want to get first of all is just, you know, you guys are some hardcore, longtime vintage collectors. You know, like what was your reaction? Like, Chris, what was your reaction when you first heard they were making new movies?
I was pretty psyched, as you will. So, not so much like from a fanboy movie standpoint, just from like breathing new life into everything, because it seemed like, you know, Star Wars is kind of stagnating, and that was a huge shot in the arm, I think, that the hobby really needed, and just a sign of thing, good things to come, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, Gus, you're pretty, like, keyed into the whole Lucasfilm structure. Or at least I read your articles in Star Wars Insider every month when I'm at Barnes & Noble's hanging out with my daughter. I mean, how does this feel sort of closer to the center of Lucasfilm? Has this been just as exciting for you guys as well?
Well, I don't have tons of interaction with the folks there, but it doesn't look like it's changed anything immediately as far as, you know, I think this is, you got a lot of the same people. I think they're very pumped from the few I've talked to who are over there. And I think most view it very positively. So, I only do a couple projects with them here and there. But in general, I think people are pretty psyched about the news. They think it's a good thing.
And I'm thinking too about Ron, who I often think about his, he's written some of the best, most strident things against the prequels that I've written and that I've read. In particular,
I have, really?
Dude, you, in 2005, you wrote a review of Revenge of the Sith on the forums, and just for some reason, you wrote out the whole thing, and you're saying how it's all going great, and then you said the whole movie just went sour when you saw Sayu Bibble for the first time.
Oh, really?
And I just for
I don't
some...
even remember that, but I'll take your word for it. I do love Sayu Bibble, whatever you pronounce his name.
I don't. Tommy, do you have?
I loved in his review on Usenet where he's like talking about Rick Oley, the pilot of the Naboo speeder, or whatever the hell it is. And
right.
He's comparing it to the movie Airplane as he's talking to Anakin in it. Gladiator
that
movie, Annie?
That's awesome. Sayu Bibble, though, is the only guy on all of Naboo who realized that a communications disruption could mean an invasion.
That's true.
Like, pretty much no one else. If he wasn't there, they would have never even figured that out.
Oh, it's outrageous, yeah. So, I mean, were you sort of like initially really excited, or were you just kind of thinking sort of more of the same, or what was your reaction?
About the Disney thing?
Yeah.
I mean, my first reaction was kind of surprised, I guess, but then it seems like I've heard a couple of rumors that something like that might happen.
Right.
I can't remember where I heard it, so it wasn't that surprising, and I guess my general reaction was just to kind of, it just seems kind of funny, like, that Star Wars would end up merging with Disney, and also kind of appropriate at the same time, so it's like one of those surprises that after you think about it for like 5 minutes, doesn't seem that surprising anymore.
Right.
So
exactly,
I guess it just kind of
yeah.
was like, yeah, Star Wars and Disney, like, that makes total sense. So, I mean, as far as the movies go, I hope they make some good ones. That's always fun to see new good movies. I wasn't super happy about the prequels. I mean, I'm not really a prequel hater. I just don't really pay that much attention to them these days. But if, you know, they make new ones, I'm sure I'll go see them. So I hope they're good.
That, and I wonder too, and this is something that I saw Chris was writing a little bit about on the forums, and I think he was the first person to really bring this home, but I mean, how do we think this will really impact us as vintage collectors? Like, Chris, what were you saying? Maybe kind of recap what you were saying about that as far as its effect on the vintage market, so to speak.
I guess from my viewpoint, I was looking at it, you know, it's one thing that's good about Star Wars is continually appeals to new generations of people, so it always keeps it in the spotlight. Whereas, you know, you look at some old toy lines, you know, if you go like the old 60s G.I. Joes or Micronauts or something, where there was like a snapshot in time where people played with things, and those people and that never transferred to a new generation of people. So now with Star Wars continuing to go, you know, I think that people, as far as vintage things go, I think people have always, even as new people into the hobby, you know, they don't have to have a nostalgic attachment, I think, to collect things.
The thing I often think about is, like, maybe you guys have a thought on this. You know, there's weird stores that exist that only sell, like, I Love Lucy memorabilia and, like, Betty Boop. Right? I mean, you guys know those stores, right, Ron? You know those stores, right?
Yeah.
And, like, mm-hmm. who's buying
yeah, they
that
used to
stuff?
Call them Disney stores, and they all went out of business.
Yeah, exactly. But, like,
there's a store by me that sold nothing but I Love New York stuff.
Oh,
wow. Orlando.
But I'm thinking, you know, that Star Wars was in danger of kind of heading into that sort of what I call a Gone with the Wind territory, where, like, people don't even remember what it was that they're so nostalgic about. But, and I mean, what do you think, Tommy? Do you think this helps specific characters more than others? I mean, how would you imagine this would work? I mean, I guess it depends on who's going to be in the movies, but how do you see it playing out in the future as far as vintage collectibles?
Well,
Well, that is one of the main discussions is who's going to be in the movies. You know, the first six movies kind of follow Vader's story.
Right.
And if he's dead, what are they going to do now? But I do think it could help specific characters. I mean, especially R2 and 3PO. I mean, they've got to be in it.
Right.
What happens there in it. So people who collect, like, those characters should be excited about it.
Right.
I think people who were fans of the expanded universe should be interested in it. Like, whether or not they're going to... I sincerely doubt they will do any movie based on... strictly on a novel or video game or anything like that. But I would be very surprised if they didn't throw in characters or environments from the expanded universe just as a way to bring newer fans in.
Right. Now, this is the big question for all of us. Ron, are you going to kill Chewbacca again?
I'm always on the lookout to kill more Chewbaccas, so if I have more opportunities, you can be sure I'll be there.
For those of you that don't know, Ron Salvatore happens to be the name of the author who killed Chewbacca in the expanded universe, and I was like, you know what? Just my luck. They're going to pick that. Although that actually probably be good for him as far as a collectible goes. I mean, what I fear is that they could actually almost hurt a character. You know, like if Leia came back and she was kind of lame. I don't know. It probably wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
And also too, I was thinking, Gus, how do you think this will change celebrations? Do you think it'll make them different, or how do you think that'll happen?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, what I've heard from people who are kind of close to Disney is that Disney generally has been hands-off with the companies they own. So if I were to just take a wild speculation on what will happen is that they'll remain hands-off and celebrations will continue every year like they're planning. So that would be my guess. I think it opens up more potential, though. I would bet that other conventions Disney's doing, if they start to include other characters from other licenses like Marvel and Star Wars and so on, that there'll be probably more options for conventions. But I my guess, and this is really a guess, I have no information on this, is that it'll affect very little of celebration, at least in the short term.
Right. Okay. So we'll still kind of be able to have crazy parties with manatees and stuff. It won't be.
I hope so. Yeah. Yeah.
But I remember Chris, you were saying something about it on the forums as well about it maybe. Or was I saying it? Or maybe it was me. I don't know. We were talking at least about it sort of making them feel more relevant. Have you felt like they've been kind of – or have any of you felt that they've been kind of weird lately since Celebration 5?
I think a very natural thing was happening over time that Celebration and Star Wars fandom in general was evolving into the diehards, which I think actually was a good thing. I mean, attendance has remained strong, you know, for the last – couple of celebrations even after the movie. So it actually is still strong interest, but I think it actually has a bigger concentration of diehards.
Right.
And I think what this does is this pulls Star Wars back into the mainstream, like, you know, and you know, not just in Celebration, but in every other type of Star Wars activity.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And I also wanted to ask a question about sort of more like remember when. Do you guys have, I mean, okay, so Steve and Tommy were both born in the late 90s, so they won't remember. but you know, the prequels were announced, at least my memory, I'll go with my memory first, was watching Entertainment Tonight in probably 1993 or 1994, and them announcing that George Lucas is going to start writing the prequels. And I was so excited that I, like, stayed up and I recorded it on a VHS tape in between Simpsons episodes. And I tried to find it. Maybe, Tommy, you could help me. I tried to find it on the web, but you look up E.T. episode 1, and it's all pictures of E.T. in episode 1. you just can't find it. So I'm wondering, like, you know, Ron, Chris, and Gus, do you have any, like, fun – where were you when you heard about the prequels?
My memory of it was more about – I would have placed it more about 95 when about those VHS editions came out. That's when I thought they started really talking about the prequels. But anyway, whenever it first came out, my first thought was like, yeah, right, I'll believe it when I see it. And I didn't really realize it was for real until I started seeing casting stuff. Remember, that was the early days of Ain't It Cool News and Harry Knowles when he was making a big impact. And he had like Ewan McGregor info and all that stuff that who was cast in the prequel. And that all of a sudden made it seem like it was actually going to happen. And I'm pretty sure that was around 97 or so, probably around the special editions.
Right.
And I don't know. I mean, it was pretty interesting that they were going to be releasing new movies. I was never that, like, I'm going to wait online for 2 months beforehand, but it was always something you were looking forward to see what they were going to do with all the new technology. And, you know, Lucas had come out and said it was all going to be super digital, like a lot of it was going to be animated, and there was going to be a whole new kind of filmmaking. And so there was that kind of excitement about it. But collecting-wise, I mean, at that point in time, I would say the vintage hobby was, like, exploding right around 94 to 97.
Okay.
With all those people coming into the 20s and 30s. Like, that was even outside of the prequels. It was just, like, everything Star Wars seemed to be huge between the re-release of the movies and the VHSs. And, like, at shows, Star Wars was everywhere. So that seemed like a really heavy Star Wars interest time in general, even without the prequels. And the prequels were just something that was, like, on the horizon, would be coming eventually in the future.
Right.
So, I mean, that was my main reaction, was I was just kind of collecting, and Star Wars seemed to be really popular, and kind of hoping the movies would be good and seeing what would happen with the casting and everything. But right. I didn't have much thought beyond that.
Now, is that your experience too, Chris, where you were just sort of just so busy collecting you didn't think that much about the movies, or did you have, like, a same kind of feeling, like, oh, this is really going to help, or what were you thinking?
I mean, at the time, I wasn't really thinking about it helping or hurting. I guess it didn't, to me, didn't have any effect on collecting, really.
Right.
And because I've never sort of been collecting because of movies, but I just remember, like, I don't know if it was as late as Ron was saying. It seemed like I was thinking more of the early 90s, you know, when the Zahn novels were coming out. There was murmurings that more Star Wars was on the horizon. It seemed like I read something in Parade magazine or something, where that when. And I remember, you know, at the time, everybody's on the Usenet, you know, a lot of the discussions were going on, lots. And at that time, it was so early, you know, we were blending the collecting speak, the movie speak, and everything was sort of all going on in the same place. And then it started to faction off after that, you know, where people were just interested in talking about films and other people were talking about things.
Right.
And split up as more and more, that got bigger. So it seemed, at the time, you know, it was just like, that things were happening. Like Ron, it was really exploding. Toy shows were great. The Men Behind the Mask started taking off. I think that was a really big deal at the time. They were doing those shows around the country. And I think that was one of the first times. I think I met Ron the first time and a bunch. I mean, Ron and about a dozen other people for the very first time face-to-face was Men Behind the Mask in Cincinnati in late 97.
Right.
And that was just a good reason to keep things going, you know, and to boost, and it's sort of like mini conventions, and then, you know, a couple of years later, you had Celebration, and then that took off.
Right, so it's almost like the energy, because, I mean, what you were describing, the similar, like, how movie talk and toy talk were blending together, I mean, you look at the threads about the new movies, and it's the first time I've seen that since, you know, 2005. I mean, people are just, you know, ranting about, I mean, I don't know. I mean, that thread's gotten pretty crazy. But, you know, it's toy talk and it's movie talk all at the same time. But what was your memory, Gus, of sort of hearing it for the first – well, first of all, where do you vote? Was it 93, 95, 94? The internet is actually not that clear. They say, like – yeah.
I think that my recollection, similar to Chris's, that I think they had trickles of hints all along the way. I don't remember any specific moment when they, you know, like, you know, the fan, there was the Star Wars Insider and it was, you know, kind of called the Lucasfilm Fan Club before that. They were already dropping hints in the early 90s. I think people saw the novels and the Dark Horse comics, you know, Dark Empire, and I remember, like, circa 93, 94. You would talk to collectors then who said, I'm going to, you know, stockpile, especially in 95 when Power of the Force 2 came out. That
right.
People were already talking prequels by then, and that they were stockpiling things, thinking that it would be, you know, a windfall once the prequels hit, because Star Wars would be back in the mainstream. And so, yeah, I remember it earlier. For me, the big moment was really when the trailer hit. Because,
right.
Like, I remember vividly, like, I was at work, downtown Seattle, and there were certain movie showings that were showing the trailer at the beginning and the end of the movie. So we, like, left the office, went few blocks of this movie theater, bought tickets just to see the trailer, and then went back to work, came back in 2 hours to see the – I forgot what movie it was, but it was some horrible
Meet
movie.
Meet Joe Black? Was that what it was?
Meet Joe Black.
That's right.
I remember that.
And we went to see it 2 times, and we're like, wow, that's an awesome trailer. I can't wait to see that movie. But yeah, I mean, I remember the trailer hitting was this big, big buzz.
Now how about this for trivia? Now, okay, that was the trailer before Meet Joe Black, but do you remember that Fox had 3 trailers that they played before every showing of episode 1? It was this kind of like triple trailer in one. Do you remember the 3 movies? I think I know 2 out of 3 of them.
Anna and the King, Fight Club.
And
one other.
Titan A.E.
Oh, yeah.
I remember seeing that thinking, that Fight Club movie looks dumb. But anyway.
I had the same reaction. I thought Fight Club was going to be dumb. And it was a brilliant movie.
That's funny.
Isn't Titan A.E. like written by Joss Whedon, though? So it's kind of funny since now people are saying that he's going to be he's one of the contenders for directing the new one.
Right, yeah. I didn't know he wrote that. I just remember that was
– I think he like script doctored it. I don't know that he wrote the whole thing.
He did.
Right. Well this
definitely.
Go ahead, Tommy.
It was definitely before 1994, though, that people knew about episode 1 because that would have been the first year I collected, and I can remember going to the first toy show, and that was the pitch from every dealer was when the special editions come out, all these toys are going to be worth so much money. And then in a few years after that, they got. 1, 2, and 3 coming out. And then after that, we have 7, 8, and 9. And so I actually went to the library and found the Zahn books and assumed those were 7, 8, and 9.
Oh, wow.
It's like I got all the way through them before I realized. I was like, why did I read these then?
I thought you meant, Sky, like the official announcement, like a press release that he had started writing. Rumors.
I don't know when it was. Like, I remember that. I can't find the Entertainment Tonight. Yeah. I remember that was like – it was just an interview with him. It wasn't an interview. It was like him walking out of a restaurant. He's like, oh, I started writing the book. I started writing it. And I just it was so exciting for me because at that time all I did was play Mortal Kombat 3. I didn't think to really get into collecting Star Wars. But I am really good at Mortal Kombat 3. I don't even know when the exact official date was. But it's just so funny how different it was that at that point, even something as big as Star Wars – even as big of an announcement as that was, you hear people saying that this is a bigger deal, which I don't know if it is. But what do you think? Do you think it's a bigger deal, Steve?
I think it could be in a lot of ways. I mean, it just depends on the new person behind the wheel, I guess. I mean, you're so used to having George as the head man, so to speak, and to actually see it in some other creative hands for once. I think it's really been refreshing for me to just think about what could be, but... I'm just cautiously optimistic, I'd say.
Right.
But, it's funny. A trailer note. I was trying to watch that episode 1 trailer. Our computer at home wasn't capable of even playing it. So I went to some computer store. But I tried to load it on one of the public stations, and the only thing that would load was the audio. So my first attempt trying to watch the episode 1 trailer was just the audio of the trailer, and that got me excited enough. I'm like, what? What is the deal?
Just those little drums, thrup-dup, right?
Exactly. I'm like, what? Oh, man. It was actually really maddening. But
that's awesome. Well, hey, Chris, I've got really good news. Because of this new exciting stuff, and this is for Steve, too, but we have a new lightning round question that I'm going to ask all of you based on 7, 8, 9. Are you ready?
So be it.
Uh-oh.
Okay. So this is for all of you, so you can think, but Chris has to answer. Chris, you have to answer first. What secondary or tertiary character do you most want to see in the postquels? Okay, I'll answer first. My answer is Lumpy. I would love it if Lumpy was brought in. I see no reason they should not go to Chewbacca's. Chewbacca doesn't have to be Peter Mayhew. They get some other tall dude. He's a tall character. He's like R2-D2 or C-3PO. You can just put him in, have it all be about the family. So that's my vote. Lumpy all the way. Chris, who do you want to see as far as secondary, tertiary characters?
I think they need to bring back the Dianoga.
All right.
And write something around him.
All right. Maybe like he could join the Luke's Jedi Academy. All right. How about you, Gus?
Yeah, I don't. You know, I think it would be elegant if they tied this trilogy to both of the previous trilogies, so that they bring back surprise characters from the first trilogy that might have lived that you didn't, like Mace Windu or something like that. And I think that would be interesting. Like Mace Windu would probably be my pick as somebody that, you know, he quote unquote died, but did you really see him die? I mean, you saw Anakin jumping on vehicles all over Coruscant, so the dude could have landed on something and gotten out of there. But yeah, I mean, that's what I would find interesting if they tied it to the whole saga, not just the last trilogy.
Okay. Wouldn't do much for vintage collecting, but you're right. It would be pretty cool.
Well, they'll do enough to tie it to the original trilogy. No worries about that. I'm sure all those characters will be back and probably get killed off in the first movie. But I think it's just nice to tie it to the whole thing.
All right. How about you, Tommy?
Kia Maul.
Okay. We all knew he was going to say that.
Thal Jovan. So
that doesn't even count as tertiary.
Yeah, it's true. Quadtertiary. So Steve, how about you?
I think I'm going to go with 9. I'd like to see some further explanation of his military career, because he was obviously on the rise by the end of the last movie. Yeah, you never know, you know?
He could be an admiral by now.
He could be.
He could be 10 num. You don't know.
Right. No,
I think 10 num exists, though, in Hasbro world, right? Doesn't he, Gus?
Which one? Maybe. I don't know.
I acknowledge no world outside of Vintage Kenner.
Okay. Yeah.
That's where it stops, yeah.
Yes, there's a 10 num in the white suit. Actually, the white, that was actually the precursor to the 9 num. I think that was the original design, and then they changed him to red, and then they went back to the old Lucasfilm photos and was like, hey, we can just create a new character here. So,
Wow. Modern super collector Chris Jorgulius. And how about you, Ron? What secondary figure besides Sayo Bibble do you most want to see in the new
trilogy? I'm going to go with Captain Tanaka.
Okay.
All right.
Because I want to hear him say the Huts of Gangsters again.
Awesome. So what do you think, Chris? Is that a good new lightning round question?
Jake, I hate the lightning round. I don't hate Market Watch. It's the lightning round, though.
Okay.
You have an intro for that.
All right. Cool. Then that's sort of like the first half of the news. And then the other part is kind of not just the post-quels being made, but the fact that Disney bought Lucasfilm. And this is really where Tommy's going to get a chance to shine. So how, you know, because you're kind of like a you're one of the few Disney fanatics that I know that does not possess ovaries. So
that makes me feel good. Thanks for that.
I'm really sure of this.
Yeah, it's true. you never know. So, Tommy, how does this?
I'm going to put that on my business cards.
So, how is this as a Disney fanatic? How are you receiving this? Not just from the Star Wars side, but from the Disney side.
In what way?
Like, just among your fellow mouseheads, is this seen as, like, a positive thing or, like maybe ambiguous because Star Wars is so powerful, you know, you're afraid of it, you know, running in and, like, taking out something awesome, like, you know, the Tiki Room or something?
The Disney fans, they've been treating it with much more restraint. They're much less militantly angry than they were about the Marvel purchase. Because there's been a long relationship between Star Wars and Disney. I mean, it's been in Disneyland since, 86? It's been in Hollywood Studios since 89. So it doesn't seem like a foreign concept like the Marvel deal does.
Right.
So they don't really have a problem with Star Wars coming into the parks or Disney controlling Star Wars. So there isn't a whole lot of problem there. A lot of people see it as something that Disney can invest their money in order to stop Universal's Harry Potter land, which is currently, you know, very popular.
Right.
Some critics point out that it's just Disney, another example of Disney going outside of itself rather than creating from within, like Walt used to do.
That's interesting.
Like, we shouldn't be buying multi-billion-dollar companies. We should be creating our own multi-billion-dollar companies.
Huh? Yeah, that's true. But you know, you're not going to do better than Star Wars, even if you do.
No.
Huh? So it seems like Yeah, I don't know. I mean, have you kind of found it maybe weird? I don't know, maybe Steve or anybody. Yeah, Steve. Yeah. The amount of, like, exuberance from the Star Wars. Do you think maybe there's a little bit of danger of us kind of going too far with our happiness?
It's based on the last go-around, I think there's some trepidation that should come along with it. But at the same time, I mean, I think, as they've shown with the Marvel stuff, they seem to be treating these extra properties with a different degree of care. And same with, like, Pixar and stuff like that. They get the right kind of creative people involved with it, and you feel better about it.
Right.
It's more of a multi-pronged attack, I guess.
Right.
The thing that I'm concerned about is what happens once Iger leaves. Like, all the purchases, the Marvel purchase, the Pixar purchase, and Lucasfilm are all under Iger. But he's out in, like, 18 months.
Mm.
Huh.
So I don't know what the next administration is going to do, because Eisner would not be having a hands-off policy with these companies.
Yeah.
So I haven't seen the contracts, but I would hope that they put something in there in writing that they have some sort of self-management.
So Iger's the CEO of Disney, just to be clear, right?
Yes. Yes, I'm sorry.
Yeah, we're not all like, you know, studio insiders like you and Steve. I always thought it was pronounced Igor. That's just me. Yeah, exactly. Without ovaries. Now, as far as some other talk, Gus, that's been happening, there was a rumor that Disney was going to buy Hasbro, and it seems like that was kind of fake. But, like, what if, because of this deal, you know, Disney has deals with Mattel and all that? I mean, do you think there's any chance that Kenner is going to have no part of Star Wars as far as action figures go?
Well, what I don't know the details of their contract, but as I understand, Hasbro has a contract out several years, so that at least for some time, whatever happens, they're going to still be doing Star Wars toys. You know, the other thing is, I understood that part of one of the deals, I don't know if it was special edition or prequels, that Lucasfilm got some Hasbro stock, like owned some portion of Hasbro. So I don't know if that changes the equation a bit. If, you know, if already basically, does Disney own a piece of Hasbro? I don't know the answer to that, but I wonder, you know, in those previous deals, Lucasfilm, I had heard, had gotten some stake in Hasbro. So I don't know if that factors in. But I haven't heard anything concrete on this, whether, you know, I don't think, you know, overnight all of Disney's holdings switch over to, like, say, Mattel. I imagine over time, as contracts expire, it becomes, you know, tempting to do a big contract for all their licenses. But I think it takes some time to sort that out. I mean, look at it today, just with Marvel, right? There's other studios that own the rights to some of these films for quite a long time. And so, so, you know, I think it takes a while to prune all that and get, you know, renegotiate contracts.
Right. Yeah. I think for the vintage hobby, obviously new movies is better, but having that Kenner logo and having them just go back to that Kenner well, I think it's a good thing, right?
Oh, yeah, I think it'd be great for nostalgia's sake to keep it consistent. But I think people are already going to have to deal with there won't be a 20th Century Fox logo at the beginning. So.
Yeah, yeah, I wanted to talk about that because actually my son, I'll put up a show link. When I told him, first of all, the absolute best part of this whole thing is if you have kids, you get to tell them that there's going to be a Star Wars movie. And then they go, really? That's awesome. And then you get to tell them, yeah, it'll be in 3 years. What?
Oh, man. That's a tough thing to drop on a kid.
Yeah, it's great. Oh, my son. But he drew this picture, and he drew a beautiful rendition of the 20th Century Fox logo. That was first thing he did. He wrote, you know, introducing episodes 7, 8, and 9. And then I was like, yeah, but they were bought by Disney. And so he just wrote on the 20th Century Fox and Disney.
Oh, perfect.
So it's so funny that even my 7-year-old associates Star Wars so firmly with that. I mean, I don't know. I mean, do you think that we're going to be able to get over this, Ron? I mean, do you have that affiliation with the 20th Century Fox logo?
It is weird, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, it'll be odd to hear to see a Star Wars movie and not have that 20th Century Fox fanfare beforehand. It almost feels like it's part of the score written by John Williams. I mean,
right, yeah.
I don't think a company fanfare has ever been so associated with a single movie, even where it seems to lead into the actual score. But, you know, people get over it. I mean, well, they're going to have to, I guess. I don't know if it's going to really affect anything, but it is certainly something funny to think about.
Yeah, I don't know. Have any of you ever had that experience when you were a kid of other movies by 20th Century Fox?
Oh, absolutely.
And you got all psyched, and then it was like, wait, what, Tombs of Endearment?
It's like a total buzzkill, right? You're like, left an alert there.
Yeah. Fortunately for those of us that are crazy Lucas apologists, we've already went through this with the Clone Wars movie because that was Warner Brothers. So you at least got the Lucasfilm logo after a Warner Brothers logo, which
you're preconditioned.
You know. Yeah. There's advantages to being a fanboy through and through. That's the other question, right? There's thoughts that they may be making movies that are not in the trilogy. They would be outside movies.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I think...
I'm wondering if they'll use the live-action TV show that they were been planning for years as some sort of plot for one of those type of movies. You know, not 7, 8, and 9, but just set in the Star Wars universe.
Right. Yeah, I think those, the idea of even just one-shot movies, I think inevitably those wind up being people's favorites because they'll be, like, different, you know? So I could see them making a movie that's, oh, I don't know, about a young Wookiee and his family and trying to figure out how to...
They conceivably release something every year, Sky. I mean, it wasn't stopping them to release some kind of thing every year. I mean, they'll certainly make money doing it, so people want to see it. Why not?
Yeah, they do.
And I like the idea of like mixing up genres, maybe, because the Star Wars universe has so many different stories you could tell. You could do like a noir type of thing. You could do straight action. You could do high drama. It'd be awesome.
Yeah. There's another thing too that I know Ron wanted to talk about, and something I've been thinking about a lot too. You sort of wanted to talk about the death of Lucas, right? So what did you mean by that, Ron?
Not so much the death. I mean, it's just an interesting. I mean, Lucasfilm was kind of like the dream come true for 70s filmmakers, you know, like these guys who came up out of film school and wanted to get independent of Hollywood and kind of have their own money to make their own things and go off away from Hollywood in Northern California with Zoetrope and Francis Ford Coppola, and they'd make art movies and stuff. And it was a nice little idea, I guess. And, you know, they tried it, and the kind of stuff that they, you know, One from the Heart from Coppola and Tucker and some other movies like that never quite made what they wanted to do. But that was kind of like the dream come true, and Lucas was the one guy to really do that. And he kind of built that little empire up there and really became the most successful independent filmmaker of all time, I guess. And, you know, you have to have a huge amount of respect for what he did. I mean, who else has a series like Star Wars under their belt, as well as all the technological innovations and stuff? So he's had a huge impact. But then you also kind of wonder about the young man, George Lucas, and what he originally wanted to do, and think, like, I wonder if he had if there's ever a regret, like, how he became kind of stuck with Star Wars. Like, did he always want to just make Star Wars movies? Did he ever want to get away? Certainly, throughout his career, he kept saying he wanted to get away and do other stuff, and it never quite worked out. So it's kind of like this Faustian thing, almost, of this guy trying to make his way in filmmaking and gets more successful than he could ever imagine, and then kind of just does Star Wars, you know, certainly isn't a bad thing. I mean, it's quite a success, but it's kind of interesting to see Lucasfilm now all of a sudden bought up by Disney and kind of realize, wow, that whole 70s thing kind of ended up in a place that no one ever kind of thought it would go there. It's just kind of, I guess, a lesson in, you know, your life really doesn't always end up like how you think it will, you know, and even if you're a huge success, it's like you maybe find yourself standing somewhere where you didn't think you would.
Right.
That's kind of the interesting thing to me. I mean, certainly not in a bad way. I mean, I think anyone would have a hard time really criticizing Lucas for what he ended up doing.
Right.
It's just kind of an interesting thing to think about.
And then the fact that he gave the money, or he says he's going to give all the money to charity, in some ways kind of brings it back to that sort of 60s, 70s Northern California ideal. Like, it's not about your money, man. It's all about the vision,
yeah,
you know?
It's just really weird. Like, yeah, like these kind of like hippie sort of guys, and then it ends up this Star Wars, which kind of ends up being this big commercial thing, you know? And then it's Disney.
Right.
It ends up in Disney. It's like, whoa, how did that happen? It's just really funny to kind of think about where things lead you over time.
Yeah, it's funny because it was at Celebration 3, I think. I was watching someone talk about the original Star Wars fonts, you know? And Lucas specifically told him, make the S as fascist as possible. Like, his goal in making Star Wars logo was to make a fascist logo. And then it became a story of rebellion, and then it became, like, his symbol. And so, you know, it was almost like someone, like, designed a swastika and was like, yeah, okay. And then that's just sort of wound up on everyone's shoes and curtains and stuff. And,
yeah.
I don't know. That's
one thing. It's kind of stupid when people really try to lay all this blame on Lucas for you know, doing what he did, you know, making a lot of money and kind of inventing the blockbuster and all that stuff. I mean, it's kind of a dopey way to look at, I think, movie history. But,
right.
I mean, it is kind of funny when you see him when he's a young guy and he's talking about making these art movies all shaggy and stuff, and then he ends up as, like, this big mogul in charge of Star Wars, which is this big toy and merchandising empire, and then it ends up being bought by Disney. It's, like, just kind of, like, leaves you scratching your head, like, wow, how did that happen, you know? And I wonder if Lucas kind of wonders that himself. You know, you think he probably does. He probably doesn't care at this point, you know? He's a
right.
huge success, so why would he sit there and worry about it? But
well,
it is kind of a funny story.
Yeah, I remember, I think, some interview, right, Gus, where he called himself Darth Vader? Do you remember reading that?
Yeah, I've read a couple things where he made some analogies to the characters. But yeah, it's interesting that arc, you know, that he's kind of was the independent filmmaker and just, you know, became this, despite hating Hollywood and the studio system, he just created a new one. But
right.
I mean, it was, you know, but it was under the one thing I'll give him. I mean, a lot of things I give him, but the one thing that's unique about him is that, that it was under artistic control, right? The other studios are all much more corporate driven in decision making, whereas he would just do things for passion, of from the way they designed the Lucas buildings to, you know, to movies he decided to do. I mean, some of it I'm sure was driven by business, but he always prided himself as not really being a businessman. And so that is one difference I think the selling to Disney will change, is I think, but that could be a good thing. I think having really good business oversight and all that could make Star Wars even better.
Right, because eventually you do want to sort of give the fans what they want a little bit more than he has. I mean, I'm the world's biggest.
I did notice, Guy, that he did do the Red Tails movie, which was something he was talking about doing for years. It was like a personal project, you know, before he got out, which is kind of an interesting thing. And I'd be curious to wonder what his whole thoughts on that is. He seemed kind of bitter about it, that he kind of blamed kind of some racial things about its non-success, I guess, but he kind of finally got that off the ground, and it didn't do that well, and then he was out, you know? So it is kind of like, there is kind of the thing where you wonder, like, he seemed to always wanted to do something else, you know, whether it was his art films he was talking about, or his, like, his black African-American World War II pilot movie, which he finally did eventually, but it was always seemed like he wanted to do more, and then it just didn't happen, you know?
Yeah.
And it was always just ended up being Star Wars, which is certainly not a bad thing, because who would not want to be associated with Star Wars? But you do wonder, like, underneath, if there wasn't something else he was hoping to accomplish there. But I guess now he's retired, so who knows?
Yeah.
Well, that happens with writers sometimes. I think Arthur Conan Doyle hated Sherlock Holmes. He wanted to kill him off.
But
people kept clamoring for more. No, Sherlock Holmes has to come back. But he hated his guts.
He did kill him. Rickenbacker Falls, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, and now Lucas – that's maybe the other great thing is Lucas could have almost killed Star Wars. Like, I honestly thought – he was going to end it where he was going to sign his will and he was going to create an ironclad thing where no one could ever make a Star Wars movie, even if it was his kids, and then that would be it. And it would be like, you know, lawyers paid in perpetuity, and then that would be it.
Chris, Gus, and I actually talked about this when we were out at Steve Sansweet's last year. I remember someone saying, Gus mentioning, oh, yeah, there's definitely going to be more movies because there's going to be so much money once he's gone. Yeah. His kids are going to make them, and that's a good point. You know, I mean, obviously someone's going to make Star Wars movies, and there's too much money on the table.
Well, I really like Bond. You know, Bond with the whole legacy of that just seems to be never-ending. And, that's
– Yeah, I remember one time around – I think it was when Episode 3 came out. I met a Lucasfilm guy I was talking to, and I was just doing the math in my head and going – it's impossible to me, like a business impossibility that they wouldn't make more movies. And he was, you know, and he had this guy I didn't know very well, but he had drank the Kool-Aid and said, no, Lucas is done. Episode 3 is it. He really is. You know, there's other things fans can do, but it won't be movies. I go, no, I just don't believe that. I believe he believes that now. I just believe you have billions of dollars and potential money to aid off merchandising and films. It becomes impossible to turn that down.
Right.
Yeah.
Now,
$1 billion is $1 billion.
Yeah. Do any of you have any memories as being a kid and knowing what Episode 7 is going to be about? I'll start while you can think about it. I was told at Burbank Elementary School, right next to the Jungle Gym, I could tell you exactly where I was, that Episode 7 was all about Han Solo being trained how to be a Jedi. And I was so psyched, and I was as certain as anything that movie was coming out in 1985. Do you have any memories of school ground certainties like that?
As a school kid, I was the only one that really knew what Star Wars was until the special editions came out. So I was kind of stuck in the no man's land as far as new movies. I thought that was it.
Because they were all like, High School Musical, woo, right?
not quite. It was more the Power Rangers, you know. Right. That was...
cool. Well, then, I think, you know, Gus
actually,
mentioned...
Actually, Disney owned the Power Rangers, too, until a few years ago. They sold them back to the original creators. Huh. But they owned the Power Rangers for years and years and years. They just didn't do anything with them.
Right.
Huh. So, go ahead. I remember in 77 telling friends when Star Wars came out, and at the time we thought it was going to be 12 films, I said to my friends, wouldn't it be funny if you go through all these movies and in the 12th one you find out Darth Vader was really Luke's father? And then, when we went to All See Empire, they were all like, how the hell did you know? I said, I don't know. I was just
father. That's awesome. Well, a little bit earlier, Gus, you were talking about creative control. And I think the big talk now, you know, if you listen to the other Star Wars podcasts, everyone's talking about directors and who's going to direct it. You know, they have the writer. It's going to be the... I didn't like Toy Story 3 or Little Miss Sunshine, so I'm a little bit bummed about that. But that's
you didn't like Toy Story 3?
How could you not like Toy
Dude,
Story
3? Dude, I'm hanging up on you.
It was lame.
Maudlin.
Yeah, that's too much. Like, all right, I get it. They're going to die. Jesus Christ. Like, you know what I mean? It was okay, but I mean, like, compared to Toy Story 1 and Toy Story 2, which are nearly flawless movies, I thought Toy Story 3 was just like, everyone wanted to love it so much because they love trilogies, but, I mean, how, like... 9/10 of that movie is like a knife at Woody's throat slitting across so that the blood just seeps out, but it doesn't hit the carotid artery. And like, you're just sitting there like, is he going to bleed to death or not? And it's just, to me, that's not drama. That's not interesting, but I digress. I'm sorry. Are you there, Tommy?
I'm still seething. I know.
It's not a coincidence, Tommy, that none of the Toy Story 3 stuff made it into the Toy Story Mania ride at Disney World. Case closed.
You want to bet? I'll bet you $100 million. Have you gone?
Yeah, it's almost enough money to buy a Lucasfilm.
Yeah.
All right. If you really want to argue with me about Disney rides, I can tell you the exact games that the Toy Story elements are in on the Toy Story mini ride.
Yeah, no, I'm pretty sure I'm right, Tommy. I'm just going to leave it at that. So,
want me to send you a video?
No, I'm just...
I'll bet you a Chewbacca focus.
Tommy, we're going to agree to disagree, okay? I'm probably right. I accept...
Look it up right now.
I totally believe that that's what you believe, Tommy, but I'm pretty much the Disney expert, so I... No, of course. Anyways, Toy Story 3 is an okay movie. It's just not a good movie. But my point is like, how do you think they're going to go with the directing? You know, like, I guess, you know, we haven't heard from Chris in a while. There's the sort of, I think, the three different ways of thinking about it. Either they're going to go with, you know, super known, like Spielberg or Peter Jackson or something. And then there's, like, the fanboy wet dreams of Joss Whedon and Christopher Nolan. And then there's sort of, like, the unknown. Which way do you think they're going to go, Chris?
I really don't care who they go with. I think that there's enough push that people... That these films, I just think they're going to do well. I think they're not going to. I think, you know, people were complaining a lot about the prequels where Lucas, you know, almost sold control over everything, you know, and things got through that maybe shouldn't have. And I think you'll probably have it so you get a well balanced group of people who know what it's going to take to make a good film. And I don't know that the director is going to make that much difference. I mean, I don't. It's better that. To know like that Hamill and Kim Fisher were approached by Lucas and then Harrison Ford's interested in. I think tying those guys in to whatever you have is going to surpass almost like the writing and the directing. I think that blending the original trilogy and this postquels, what are you calling them? Like a nighttime sleep aid, but I think something like just the character's involvement there would surpass any input that one director is going to have over the other. I'm not going to hire, you know, I'm sure it's not going to be shoddy by any stretch, but I don't know that that's going to make that much difference. But of all of us, Ron, I would defer to whatever Ron thinks. He's a movie expert. So
me? I mean,
yeah.
I think Chris is right. I think it doesn't really matter. They're going to be successful, but.
Right, but I mean, as far as like making them good, right, which we're still hoping, right?
I mean, yeah, I'll throw out a wild card. I thought Kenneth Branagh did an awesome job with Thor. I thought that was one of the more fun Marvel movies. It had like a crazy Wagnerian quality about it.
Yeah.
And, I think he did well with the drama parts of it as well. And I think he would not be a bad Star Wars director if he got a good screenplay.
As long as he's not in it, right? Because, like, that Frankenstein movie
mean acting in it, but I thought he did a really good job with Thor. Thor was kind of fun and weird.
Yeah, no. I think
Josh Whedon is more of a sitcom director. I like him. I like the Avengers, but, I mean, most of it works on the dialogue and the guys arguing about stuff, and I don't know, unless you have a big ensemble, if that's going to work for a Star Wars movie, but maybe they'll have a lot of Jedi sitting around arguing and stuff, like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and it'll work out.
Right. Yeah.
Guillermo del Toro would be a good guy to try to tap, you know, especially since he didn't do The Hobbit. Like, he's got an interesting quality to his movies, I think.
Yeah, I worry about the Joss Whedon and the J.J. Abrams and all, just like, something about it, like, what I worry about is that now that Lucas doesn't have complete control, that nerd culture will just take over and try and make it the Dark Knight. And, like, the Dark Knight's...
Isn't Kathleen Kennedy in charge of the...
Yeah, yeah.
She's pretty sharp, I think. I mean, yeah. I think they'll really find someone who's good to go. I mean, I guess Joe Johnston is an obvious choice, but I don't know. I mean, he's certainly okay. I mean, he's a good effects guy, but his movies always just seem kind of flat and workmanlike to me. Like, I didn't love Captain America as much as I liked Avengers or Thor. So, I mean, I don't know. But he seems like a natural pick considering his connection to the series.
But
especially after the Kobe and the Star Hunters episode of Droids. That was...
All right. But the other thing about Joe Johnston, too, I mean, have you guys seen Jurassic Park 3 recently?
No.
You have to watch that movie again. Through, like, the spectrum of it being the highest grossing, like, queer studies movie ever. It's like, it is a completely, unbelievable. It is a treatise on homosexuality, and I don't mean that in a joking way. Watch Jurassic Park 3 again. I swear to God, the whole thing is about how Samuel's character.
You're not confusing him with Top Gun or something?
No. It's not like that. It's not like snarky. It's like, it's really about Samuel just being kind of an old, you know. Just watch it again. Do you like notice about Gladiators, Rick Oley? Anyways, Steve, am I going to have to edit that out?
No, that's pretty cool.
Joe Johnston is the kind of guy. I think Johnston makes like good, like I think you give him a screenplay and he makes the screenplay and like he does a decent job and it comes out all right. But he just kind of, there's something not there about him as a movie maker. Just flat and kind of.
Well, he's always trying to be Spielberg.
Kind of dull. I don't know.
I've heard that Jurassic Park 3 script was basically written on set, like, the day of.
I wouldn't be surprised, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I just watch it again. Look at it through that way as being, like, kind of like a treatise about you know, a really heavily, like, all... Anyways, just watch it.
What do the dinosaurs represent, then? Like, society?
No, I don't think...
Society,
I don't think it's an allegory.
Being able to accept their love?
It's if you watch the movie.
Cool metaphor, dude. I'm gonna go watch that right now.
Good. We'll see it. We'll start a whole other podcast. Sky gets attacked by Glad podcast. But I don't mean it like in a derogatory way. It's very kind of. Anyways, just watch it again. There's certain scenes like the way they film men and. Anyways, but look, I wanted to. This is you see, Steve. This is my problem. I was all psyched because this was going to be the beautiful segue to part two of our mega cast. But I blew it by talking about Sam Neill being a gay paleontologist. Steve, how was I going to make this segue?
Get back on track here.
How was I going to make this segue, Steve? Can you help me?
I think it's possible though if they do go the scattershot route with Star Wars and they just start making like a movie every year, like whether it's part of the big series or just like a one-off thing, like that would be an interesting
forum for, you know, young filmmakers or to try out different filmmakers in different roles to give them a Star Wars movie and see where it goes. I mean, that would be quite an interesting platform for, I think, fantasy and action directors to go with. Because, I mean, almost anything Star Wars is going to make money, so they might as well just keep cranking them out.
Right.
As long as they don't dilute everything too much. But right. I think they can go with a number of different avenues with that.
I think you're right. And let's not forget that the benchmark here isn't George Lucas. The benchmark is Richard Marquand and Irvin Kershner. Now, RoboCop 2 is a fine movie, but, like, those aren't exactly titans of world cinema, even though those two
I love
movies,
Irvin Kershner.
Yeah, but he's not a titan of world cinema, right? Or do you think he is?
Well, maybe not a titan. But.
Okay, see, well, you were supposed to save me. How am I going to make the segue? Because the whole idea was, here we have the vintage intelligentsia, and I thought, why not have our usual features with these guys on the line, you know, super polyvocal. How could we possibly talk about Boba Fett segueing out of Joe Johnston?
Well, he was the one of the designers for that look, so...
Is that true?
Yeah, that's all we had to say.
Did he design? Did he design Boba Fett?
Yeah, I mean
he did. Yeah, right.
He did, like, those early sketches are all Johnston sketches.
Yeah.
And there's one way you can segue. There's that Kenner sketch. It's on the archive of the 12-inch figure that was based on the Joe Johnston sketch. But the Kenner was starting to design the Joe Johnston white suited Boba Fett initially.
Right. You see, that there was the segue right there, Steve.
There it is. We got it.
It works out well. So I think that's what we're going to do. We're going to sort of rely on all of your expertise here and just try to, like, go through and talk about Boba Fett. Steve and I were joking that Boba Fett always gets the coolest everything. And here it is, his month, and he gets the announcement of 7, 8, and 9. It's unreal. But I was thinking, why not do... like a vintage vocab, Steve. So should I put in the drop right now for that?
We let them folks change our vocabulary. Change our vocabulary.
Sakura, Frosty, MIB, MGJ, CMYKUC. It's vintage.
All right, Steve, we're back. Vintage vocab. So why not go to the Rocket Fett, right? I mean, we got the big hitters here. We're not going to talk about, you know, painted, pale, palatoy knee, you know. I don't even know what that means, Steve. Do you know what that means?
No.
Okay. It means something, and we just alienated all of our European listeners. I'm sorry. At least we'll be talking about cricket again soon. But I'm trying to think, first of all, the absolute easiest question in the world, and I'm going to address this to Tommy, the history of the keeper of the hobby holocron, the nerdiest thing that's been said on an already nerdy show. What is a Rocket Fett, Tommy?
I don't know, Sky. That's why I listen to your show. What is a Rocket Fett?
Thanks, Tommy.
I want to say the first person I ever heard use that term, I think, was probably Gus.
I used it a lot, but I don't think I was the first.
Huh, that's so funny that, you know, we take it so for granted, the term Rocket Fett, that we just think it's always been there, but it's true. We could.
I remember Gus telling me he wanted to have a vanity plate Rocket Fett, but it didn't fit on. Or
and it was taken.
Oh, that's so funny. So, Tommy, you're not going to tell the absolutely new listener who's just listening to the show because they want to hear more people talking about the post-quills. You're not going to tell them what a Rocket Fett is?
They're on their own.
All right. Steve, would you like to?
It's a Boba Fett action figure. They advertised it as having a rocket feature. But when you received your Fett figure in the mail, it came with a little note saying that there was a choking hazard and that it didn't have that feature anymore.
Right. Now,
Rocket Fett are internal samples and prototypes that still have that feature.
Now, the big question I've had is, I know Chris and Gus and Ron, you've all fired Rocket Fets before, right?
Yep.
Right.
Have
you tried to choke yourself with them? Is it possible?
If it were possible, do you think they'd be talking to you now, or would they be dead?
That would be the best death ever. Oh, my God. Can you believe it? Just found in your apartment, you know, your rancid corpse with, like, a $4,000 rocket stuck in your throat.
But what a way to die.
Yeah.
Legendary.
He did it. Someone finally died because of the rocket fed.
I actually looked up the case, the Battlestar Galactica lawsuit, which prompted it, but I couldn't find it. So wherever it was tried, they didn't appeal. So there's no.
There's something on the archive. You know about that, right?
Yeah, the newspaper articles.
Yeah. So yeah. I remember when I posted looking, that years ago. I got some.
I was looking for the. I was looking for the actual legal case though on Westlaw. But they only do cases that have some precedent, so I don't think it was ever appealed. It was probably settled.
When I posted that years ago, I got some nasty email about how I was a callous individual because I was making entertainment out of some kid's death or something. And I felt like a horrible person.
Did you take it down?
No.
Yeah.
It's there. There's a thing like it's like the death certificate. And the funny thing, well, not funny, but interesting thing is they wrote that he took on a Star Wars toy. Yeah, exactly.
You know, really?
I think it says Star Wars. But actually, it says Star Wars toy or Star Wars. You know, just because it was, you know, the layman just putting him writing that in there. But that was interesting.
I think I found that
the size of the missile was.
Yeah. I think I found it on the Battlestar Galactica site or something. Like there was something. Someone sent it to me, and I think it was on a Battlestar Galactica site. And I was like, "Holy crap! I can't believe it."
Wow, that's crazy. I didn't know they called it a Star Wars toy right there.
It's on the archive.
Wow. Well, at least they didn't. Yeah, that's
somewhere in there.
That's somewhere. So then a more precise question.
I think it started with that.
Yes, Chris.
I was gonna say, guys, started with because the Battlestar Galactica had the little missiles that were in the Colonial Viper and in the Cylon Raider toy. They're about the size of the rocket jet missile as it was designed, which is the size of the missile that they eventually glued into the backpack. But you know, I think that was the first thing because that definitely fits within the little choke hazard testing. A gizmo that they use to determine, you know, what determines a choke hazard or not. It's like this little tube that's like an inch diameter.
Okay.
But then beyond that, the Kenner people had a problem with the mechanism itself. Once they went from the L slot, they turned it to the J slot. I guess we'll get into that later too. But actually,
why don't you do that now?
The mechanism itself was breaking off.
I see. Why don't you tell us what an L slot is and a J slot is?
Tell you now what a J slot is. Okay, so that's collector speak. Actually, Rocket Fett's collector speak. You know, originally people refer to it as the missile firing Boba Fett. And after you write that so many times in your Usenet postings, after a while, people just started to say Rocket Fett. And that's where Rocket Fett came from. And then beyond that, you know, you needed a way to describe it was known that there was two different shapes of the slot in the backpack that actually controlled the little slide that moved. That shot the rocket out of the pack. So there was like the L slot, which is a backwards L shaped cut in the backpack, and then it turned. The next version was the J slot, where it was a J shape, and that was to keep you from accidentally just knocking the firing mechanism over. You'd have to like physically pull it down to loop it around this little protrusion in the backpack, and then you could fire it. And it was that little protrusion that was breaking off in their safety test, and that was creating a sharp hazard. I mean, when you broke off a little slip of plastic, it would turn into almost like a little piece of glass that you could cut yourself. Now that was the final blow for why they decided to kill the rocket firing feature.
Okay, so the L slot happened first.
It wasn't actually.
And that was too easy to do.
The L slot happened first, and then J slot.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I think if the J hadn't broken off, if that little bit hadn't broken off, it probably would have been okay. From what we were told, I talked to a few different people about it. You know, we'd go to Cincinnati, and I was always like, hey, what do you know about this? And that was the story. It was like, it was fine except for that little piece breaking off.
Right. And then as far as the difference between the J slots and the L slots, I don't know, Gus, you probably know as well as anyone else does. So then Is one of them considered to be more rare or more valuable or more interesting than the other?
Well, you know, it's a bit subjective. So, you know, some like the J slot better because it's closer to the kind of final production figure. And they generally have been a bit tougher. I mean, they're both tough to find, but the J slot ones have been, you know, tougher to find. But I don't know. I think there's more demand for the L slot in general. Like, I think people like that original design. So it's hard to say. I mean, I've seen the price on those things have fluctuated a lot over the years. Actually, they were getting, you know, they're going for a lot, and you know, and but I don't. I think there, you know, it depends. There's some collectors who just will take any form. Some are looking specifically for L or J. J, I think, is rarer, but L, I think, has slightly more demand. It's my opinion.
Okay, that sounds like you've thought about it. That's like a pretty good answer. Yeah. Because Chris was talking about kind of meeting some of the collectors and stuff, I thought, what do you think, Steve? Should we maybe try and see if we can get a story time out of these guys?
Get at least one, maybe a few.
All right, cool. All right. So. Here's an oldie but goodie. Once upon a time, long ago,
Ticcolo Carbon. Ticcolo Carbon story time. Hit it, hit it.
Toronto, gosh. All right. So Steve, we're back here in story time. I just played my little Slick Rick drop there. I'm so proud of that one. And basically, you know, I've been able to have conversations with these guys over the years, and they've told me these stories about these finds in Cincinnati and being world travelers. Well, I guess Ohio travelers, but world travelers too. And just sort of finding all these amazing toys that are worth thousands and thousands of dollars now. And we've never really had a chance to talk about them beyond the Virginia Jarvis Brooks scandal.
Right.
and so let's talk to Ron, see if he has any interesting stories about, let's just take rocket firing FETs as an example. Do you have anything to tell us, Ron?
I got two short ones that you can take or leave.
We'll take.
The first one is, I think Gus, Chris, myself, Todd Chamberlain, and maybe one or two other people went out to Cincinnati, probably in the, late 90s. And one of the things we bought on the trip was from a guy who had worked in the model shop. He had a bunch of slides from Toy Fair.
Okay.
And so, obviously, just normal traditional slides. So you can't really tell what's on them just sitting there in your hotel room or whatever. But we got tons of them, and it's like, oh, these are all the original Toy Fair displays. John Wooten still lives out there in Ohio, and he had met up with us. And so we sent him home with all those slides. And he was supposed to scan them on a flatbed scanner he had that had a slide attachment. And so back in those days, I mean, I was talking to John quite a bit, and I wasn't working or anything. So, I mean, we'd be late at night, and like 3 in the morning, we'd be chatting on AOL Instant Messenger. And he's like scanning the slides and sending them to me as he scans them so I can see them. And one of them is of the carded figure rack. And there's clearly a Boba Fett. It's like 1979 Toy Fair, you know. And it's like, I'm like, John, look at that. I mean, it looks like the card looks different, you know. It's like, doesn't look like the regular 21-back Boba Fett. And he's like, yeah. And he's looking through the slides, and he's got another one. It's a close-up of the same thing. So he scans that, and he sends it over. This is all in real time. And I get it, and we're both looking at it, and we're just, like, flabbergasted, you know. It's, like, completely different. Like, I can't remember exactly what it is, but, like, the traditional one has the fireball with the text and everything saying that, you know, it doesn't say anything about a removable rocket or anything. And this one in there, I think it mentions on the card that it has a rocket firing mechanism, and the card is different, and it's different in a way that couldn't be really, you know, faked. You know, it's like you know it's real. It's like, and this is 1979 Toy Fair, and it's like, holy cow, this is a carded Boba Fett, and it's probably rocket firing. And right. I think it had a rocket firing Boba Fett standing next to it on a little stand, you know,
oh,
and
man.
You can see the back with the rocket fire. So we're like, holy crap, this is awesome, you know, we're like, blah, 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 blah. And immediately sending off messages to Chris and Todd and Gus. And, you know, and so that, whatever. I mean, that's cool. You know, cool picture surfaces. I swear, not a month later, Eric Janicki comes up. A collector named Eric Janicki lives down in, like, the Maryland or Delaware area. Or I think it was Maryland. Just randomly finds a carded Boba Fett that's rocket firing that he picks up from a guy who says he had got it at the original at Toy Fair. And, like, he was at Toy Fair for some reason.
and he asked to have it, and someone gave it to him. Some story like that, and he saved it for all these years. And so Eric ends up with this thing, and it's like, it's going around. I think he brought it up to Tom Derby at Cloud City or something, and Tom's like, I don't know, man. Anyone could make something like this, you know?
Right.
And the story gets around back to me and John and the other people, Gus and Chris and Todd, and we're just like, oh, my God, you know, this thing actually matches up exactly with this slide.
Wow.
And how crazy is that? I mean, that you would find this thing in a slide, and then someone would make this find, this completely random find, like a month later.
Right.
And if we had found that slide, people would have just been like, who knows? Can't tell if it's real, can't tell if it's not. You know, maybe it is, maybe it's not. But because it matched up exactly with this slide from 79 that turned up before he found it, that made all the difference in the world. And of course, he sold it for a ton of money. And I'm not even sure who has it now, but I mean, that was just like
it was sold at the,
it makes your eyes pop out of your head.
Yeah, at the 2008 Premier Collectible Auction, right? Wasn't that the Premier
thing? Yeah, that's right. I remember the guy who has it now. Yeah, I don't know if he still has it or not, but he tried to auction it off.
Wow,
but just
that's
one of those
awesome
things where a piece of reference material completely dovetails with like reality and kind of, you know, cement something as being real.
Right.
The other story is just really brief. Like, I remember when I was doing custom figures back in the day in the 90s, just messing around with – I'd gotten the 79 products for delivery catalog, which has the Rocket Fire and Boba Fett in it, and it's the kitbashed Fett or the proto Fett or whatever you want to call it, the conceptual Fett.
Okay.
And I remember looking at it and being like, this thing has Stormtrooper arms, and you could tell that the torso is a 3PO torso, and the legs are – Death Squad Commander, you know, with some alterations and stuff. And I remember emailing Chris about that and him being like, oh, man, I never realized that and blah, blah, blah. And after that, I started making custom figures made up of those parts.
Uh-huh.
And I'd sell them on a card. And, you know, I sold a bunch of them to people who were just interested in having them. And I used to put them on eBay. And one of the guys who bought one from me on eBay was a guy named Walt Steuben. And I got his address. He's like, oh, I just sent you payment. You know, here's my address, Walter Steuben. I'm like, Walter Steuben? I'm like, are you the Walter Steuben who was the big-time collector in the 80s? And he's like, yeah, that was me. You know, I was on TV and everything. And I was like, I can't believe it. This guy just buying a figure off me, you know. And he was like, oh, I still buy things here and there. And we were chatting for a while. And I eventually put him in touch with Steve Sansweet, who was happy to get back in touch with him again. I don't know if those guys ever did anything. Probably just said hi to each other. But it's just one of those crazy events where someone from, like, the deep recesses of the Star Wars hobby, like all of a sudden pops up out of nowhere to
right
buy this goofy custom figure from you. So,
oh, that's awesome.
Those are my two stories.
Cool, man. Those are pretty sweet. I love the reference material and just thinking about seeing the way that figure is presented in the catalog for that auction. You know, it's just like this pristine, most amazing, you know, world's coolest figure ever. And just the idea that it's just kind of floating around at one point and matched up.
Just imagine it would probably not have been saved unless that guy was at Toy Fair and was like, hey, you think I could take this? I think that was the story. Maybe Chris or Gus remember in more detail. But the memory is that he was just there as like somebody at Toy Fair, and like he asked for it and someone gave it to him, and then the guy just saved it for all those years. And I think he'd worked at Toy Store or something, so he ran into Eric and mentioned he had it.
Wow.
Eric was like, oh yeah, you know, I'm interested in that.
Wow, that's awesome. How about you, Gus? Do you have any fun stories about
I mean, there's always, you know, over the years, we, you know, I think, you know, even though there aren't that many Rocket Fets, if you think about how many are in circulation, it's got to be under 100 or something. But, you know, it seems like we came across quite a few. I mean, I've seen L's and J's from various sources. You know, nothing like, I mean, definitely the Eric Janicki story is awesome. I remember when Eric discussed that at the time, and it was just, you know, he was entertaining a couple bids on it. But the great thing about the one Eric found, just one more thing to add on that, is that the particular, you know, since it was a mock-up card, the photo that they used in the card was offset a little bit from the one that they ended up producing. So it was a detail that nobody faking it would know. So I remember when I first saw the photos, I was like, just perfect conviction that was an accurate, you know.
Yeah, screen match, so yeah.
But, you know, I remember when I got the first Rocket Fed, I picked the one, you know, that I still have to this day, the L slot. It was pretty early in my prototype collecting. And at the time, I was a grad student, so I didn't have a lot of money to buy prototypes. And Greg Hansen, who's a collector I knew, had one, and he wanted to sell it. And, you know, he wanted you know, at the time, a lot of money for it, and it ended up, I was making at the time like $1,000 a month as a grad student, and he wanted $3,000 for it. I said, well, that's like 3 months of my income to go buy this thing. And I remember thinking it was a really crazy kind of thought process. Well, how would you, like, you know, just do that? Like, that kind of sacrifice is really crazy. It's not advice I'd give people. Like, spend 3 months of your salary on some item that you really can't afford. But at the time, I just was kind of bullish on both, Rocket Ring both, that, you know, I just had this gut feeling that's, you know, just the demand around it. And so I did this major sacrifice for months just to be able to afford that thing. And then, you know, of course, you know, now they go for a bit more, but, and that was worth the sacrifice. And then it was like one of the first prototypes I picked up, and then it went, you know, kind of crazy after that.
Well, I was trying to, I knew you were going to ask about, you know, things we had seen, what we had turned up, and I started going through some old notes, and I didn't exhaustively go through it, but literally I counted 10 that we turned up. Five of which were hand painted L slots. One of those five was the proto molded one, which is the earliest known rocket set around.
Which and turned up in a garage, didn't it?
The exact same. I think
it was a shed or something.
It might even the garage. It was in this little knitted. They kept it in this little knitted.
Yeah.
Like, little hand puppet thing. It was funny, but yeah, it was striking. All those hand painted ones. Gus was saying earlier about the L's being more common than the J's, and that was true. Except if you start getting into like those hand painted ones, there are some hand painted L slot figures out there that had more like the production looking paint, and those were pretty scarce. Yeah, but some of them were kind of beat up, and you know you had to be a real completist. I think several of those ended up in that, you know, the famous photo of the 9. Boba Fett's in a row, and I was looking across it. I think at the time I was telling somebody, like, pointing to the Celebration 3 going, yeah, we found this one and this one and that one and that one. And some of this came from the Earth that went into that collection, because the Earth, they used to have their store in Cincinnati, and they turned quite a few. I bought my rocket set from them originally. You know, they probably had turned up at least half a dozen, you know, at the time, you know, that this was sort of like mid to late 90s. And they're around. Yeah, so I used to track these things pretty hardcore. I think I was up to, I knew of about 65 or so different versions of the Rocket Firing Boba Fett. And I knew still, I mean, years later, I would see things come up. I was like, I wonder if that's a new one. Or, and I would try to figure out, is this a new one or is this one that's gone through, and keep putting the chain of ownership in there to know, oh, this is the same one that was here, and here was the original Kenner source, and trying to track them that way. So, I mean, they're still rare, but, you know, it's still, you know, that kind of quantity was still around. Of course, nowadays you see them, everybody wants them beast and everything, which is fine. I'm not a big fan of having that giant COA case with the rocket side, but that's
Wait, 65? I had no idea. Steve,
yeah.
How many did you think there were, Steve?
I mean, I didn't think there were that many, but...
Yeah, that's not that rare. I mean, that's one of the reasons I never really got one. I remember Gus being kind enough to hook me up with a chance to buy one for like $3,000 or $4,000, like a long time ago, and even at that time being like... Well, of course, now I didn't buy it just because it's worth so much more, but it's always been one of those things that always was kind of like, I'd rather hold on to my money and maybe get something else.
Right.
Just because it seemed like it's just one of those things that they're around, you know, but, you know, certainly the value of them is enough to just buy it to say that you're going to buy it as an investment at this point, you know, if you get one for cheap enough.
Right. Well, I think, you know, Steve, that I was going to go to the Nugget, but I think we should head into Market Watch instead.
Yeah, yeah.
We're talking money. What do you think, Tommy? You haven't talked in a while. You want to go to Market Watch?
Sure.
$1 Flicks. Market Watch.
At least he doesn't pick on you in a Jurassic 3 sort of way.
Yeah, right.
You ever heard about a Compassaurus? I'm telling you, you guys are going to watch it. You're going to be like, wow, that guy sure is insightful and perverted.
Well, that actually makes me
That's
like
a gay dinosaur movie.
All right, so let's talk money then. So I mean, what's the first sale you can remember? We'll go back to Gus. What's the first sale you can remember of a rocket firing fit?
I guess the earliest ones I remember were the few that I think I would guess the Earth turned up a couple, and it ended up being the genesis for the story of the Tomarts ran. So Tomarts did one of the earliest stories on Rocket Fett, if not the first. And they got an L slot. I think they got an L. I'm going to try to play this back. I think they had got a J slot out of it. Anyway, there was a couple that turned up from one. I think it was a tester at Kenner who, I think Steve Sansweet got his J slot from that. I think that's where Greg Hansen got his L slot. So there were a few that turned up from the Earth very early on, and it was and one was sold to Tomarts, which was the one that they had in the story about the L and the J slot.
Okay, and that sold for how much? Do you remember?
You know, I don't, because a lot of these were other folks who bought them, but I thought they were on the order of $3,000, like that range.
Okay, around $3,000 and around 99, something like that.
No, this is earlier. This is
earlier than that.
94, 95.
Oh, wow.
Okay. And then how did they go up by 99? Did they go up by,
by Star Wars, like I think the peak for vintage sales was like kind of 97 to about 2002.
Okay.
That like 5-year stretch. And around there, I mean, the L slots with Rocket were getting up to like 15,000, even higher. Some even sold for more than that at peak. And J slots, some of them were selling in that range as well. I think the high, I mean, there were some I'd heard, you guys can chime in if you heard other ones, but I heard some going as high as like 18, but 15, there were multiple that sold at 15 around that time.
Wow. But I mean, one sold last month, right? For how much, Steve? Do you remember?
I think it was about 20,000, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was about 20. So it seems like.
Wow. Okay.
Yes.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Well, which kind was it? I didn't see that.
Tom Derby codified it as the one that was going to be sold to Ron. So I think it got a premium. But it was the one that Gus offered him for three. No.
3,000?
No, you know, I have it right here, actually. CIB. Let's see. Boba Fett L slot rocket firing. And. That's pretty much it, and it's it's got the big paper, yeah, and it sold for $20,000.
Just documentation wise, the earliest mention I've found about a Rocket Fett is in what do they call it? TKRP, which is the Tom Kennedy radio program. He had a classified publication he put out that collectors used to advertise in the early '80s, looking for stuff.
Wow.
Steve Sansweet used to run big ads in these, and I have some of the copies of them. And he's the only guy in that classified publication who's looking for a rocket-firing Boba Fett. And this is in the early '80s.
Oh my God.
An interesting little data point there. Show you how far ahead of the curve he was.
Yeah.
And also, if you could find it, there's a zine called Report from the Star Wars Generation. I think it's what it was called.
Okay.
Which is in zines, which is like pre-blogging, pre-internet being a big thing.
Right.
Early '90s that had a whole issue devoted to is there not a rocket firing Boba Fett? And this is like maybe 92 or something like that, which is a pretty interesting little piece of paraphernalia. And I think what Gus was talking about, the Earth finding the J slot, they did a Tomarts issue where they announced the existence of that in about 94. I don't know exactly what issue it is, but I remember vividly, before I even knew Gus or Chris, seeing that Tomart article where they described the J slot as being a new discovery. And so those are things that people who are history minded can probably try to dig up just to have it, you know.
I thought the Larry Hines ones, which were fake, turned up in early 94, and I thought those predated Tomarts. Because Tomarts kind of set the record straight on what – it was the first time people had really good photographs of the prototype.
Yeah.
Rocket Fets, and I thought that might have been later 94, early 95 when Tomeworks came out, because the Larry Hines thing I remember happened while I was on vacation when he was selling, like when Chip had one and all that in early 94, and I was on vacation and I came back and I heard all these people. When I came back after, it was a long vacation, I came back and like three people I knew had Larry Hines Rocket Fets during the time I was out. I was like, oh, that's interesting.
Wow. Yeah, that's crazy. And so Tommy, did you know about this radio show from the early 80s that has Steve Sansweet asking for Rocket Fets?
Oh, sorry, Scott. He had a radio show.
Oh, okay.
That was like his main business, but he also on the side. The radio show, I don't think had anything to do with Star Wars, but on the side he published. He sold Star Wars stuff through catalog, and then he had a classifieds publication he put out for collectors to look for stuff.
I was picturing like Tradio or something, where it would be like, you know, like a young Steve Sansweet being like, "Hi there, I'm looking for Rocket Fets." Okay, you know,
they're just like little print ads, you know.
Okay,
it's an interesting publication though, if you can find it. I mean, he was selling back issues for a while.
Yeah, and you had. I mean, are those in your scrapbook, Chris? No, that's all just because Chris Joglius' scrapbook, right, has all the old sales.
I can take a picture for you if you want. But Chris's scrapbook is Toy Shop.
Right, it's just Toy Shop.
But yeah, if you want a who's who of like vintage collecting in the real early days with the original guys, like TKRP catalogs are it. Like that's where all the games at the time were collecting vintage Star Wars. It's really interesting and nostalgic to see.
Yeah, well, I think we have a mission. That sounds great. The report from TKRP.
I'll scan some of them.
Yeah, that's awesome. So then it seems like it went from. I mean, were they – so it seems like they went from being found to being sold for $3,000 with little in between, huh? Just kind of they were sort of – once you realize what they were worth, there wasn't a period of time like proofs or something where they were sold for $20 between people or like as far as you know, Gus, there's nothing like that?
I'm not aware of any sales of authentic ones for cheap early on. And I think it actually took a while for people to get good photographs, and it was really Tomar's breaking. I think they were the first to really break the story with photographs of one.
Right.
Even though some people had them prior to that, like Tom Neuheisel had one, and he, you know, he's had his since he was at Kenner in the late 80s. But so there were people who had them. Steve Denny, of course, had some from the late 80s. So there were people who had them, but they just didn't seem to get photographed and well-known in the community what they would look like till later. And I'm not aware of any sales for very cheap in the early 90s or anything like that.
Right. Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's possible, right? They could keep going up. I mean, what do you think, Chris?
Could they possibly go up? I think they definitely dipped down, and it didn't seem that long ago where they were kind of down. It was like sub 10,000, you know, 8,000, 9,000. And then it seemed like in a short amount of time, the sales, you'd start seeing the sales jumping back up to where they were. They didn't really surpass their high point, you know, as far as the standard Boba Fett was the standard Rocket Fett, like the unpainted L slot. That's sort of like the one people know the most. It's identifiable, you know, and then some of those specialty ones is definitely they surpassed, you know, they were selling for in the low 20s, you know, and the carded one sold for, they were asking like $100,000 or something at that PCA auction back in 08, I think it was, San Diego Comic-Con. But will they go higher? It's hard to know. I mean, the thing is, you know, for a time when they were being found and gobbled up at the same time and the prices were really going up, but it's been years since, you know, they've really turned up. So I think most of the initial supply has run out. I think the ones you see now are the ones that are going back into the marketplace, and they're being graded by, you know, Tom, collectible investment. And, you know, I think people are accepting that sort of like the standard, quote, investment grade Rocket Fett. You know,
right.
you get it, and it's got the COAs inside it, you know, and you know, people have their centerpiece. And if you have, you know, room to display it the way that's vertically oriented like that, but... And those are the ones, you know, you see on eBay, and I think people have more peace of mind. I think before people may have been more reluctant, but maybe just the visibility of that piece, you know, it's, you know, you gasp like, oh, like there were 65 or whatever. I mean, there are so many vinyl Cape Jawas out there that still sell for a ton of money.
Right.
You know, that people pay a lot of money
for a high-grade 12-back Luke, and that's not, you know, there's tons of those things out there, you know, and
right.
So it's really demand, and that's just such a high physical figure that, you know, will it always, I mean, the thing is, you cross a $10,000 threshold, it's really a psychological barrier for collecting, you know?
And, yeah, yeah, man, that's pretty good stuff, Steve, right? I think
we got a lot of history with that market watch.
A lot of history, a lot of market watch, you know, kind of keeping it current. I guess the way I think of it, and maybe this could go into a comic book collector like Tommy's mind, is, you know, every time, you know, Detective Comics number 27 sells for $500,000, everyone goes, oh my God, it'll never sell for that much. But then the next person who wants to own the best comic book spends $1 million. And then everyone says, oh my God, it won't be, you know, I can't possibly stay that much. And you just wonder how many people with too much money keep showing up and say, I want the best. And they just keep saying they'll buy that, you know?
Yeah, well, really established hobbies always seem to have that holy grail item, you know, the Honus Wagner card, or, you know, the Detective Comics, whatever it is, and,
right.
You know, is always going to keep setting new precedents because it remains the pinnacle of this hobby. So,
right.
I mean, I guess the question is, Star Wars is a big hobby. Is action figures the quintessential Star Wars collecting arena? You know, if so, is the Rocket Fett the quintessential piece?
Right.
I mean, I guess it's one of them. I mean, I don't know if it keeps going up, but, I mean, why not? I mean, other big items have kept going up, so.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, on that point, like, Honus Wagner card, the high water mark on that was $2.8 million for a near-mint one. So, you know, there's a lot of headroom, and not that the Star Wars thing will ever get to that point, but lots of Wagner cards have sold in hundreds of thousands, you know, to give an idea. And
yeah.
Rocket is probably the Honus Wagner card of Star Wars collecting.
Yeah, that's a good way of thinking of it. Yeah, and I
think on some of those, it's like condition is such a big deal. It was funny, I was just watching American Pickers the other day, and they had an amazing fantasy number 15, the first edition of first appearance of Spider-Man.
Yeah, 15.
Well, the high grade one had sold for $900,000, but their copy was pretty. It was good shape. You know, it was $4,000. But you don't have that with the Rocket Fett. They're like all good condition. You know, so
there's not a.
So it's actually a better precedent. See, they're all sustaining the high value versus there's this really nice one, and then the rest of them are at one-tenth of that. And that's not the case with these, where it is with, like, the Honus Wagner cards and the comic books. It's really those particular few graded, high-graded ones. It's not like the overall all those books are that expensive, you know, so... You sort of hit this peak with the Rocket Fets are $15,000, but they're all sort of like that. They're not. There's no $2,000 one because there's really not any beat to death ones that you're really going to find. You know, most of them are in decent shape, so
right.
They're all comparable.
Except for the one that eventually kills Steve when he chokes on it. But yeah, so let's maybe we can go to a nugget, and I think for that,
tis a nugget. From the archive, tis a nugget.
Oh my God, they're gorgeous.
From the archive.
Oh my God, they're gorgeous.
Oh, it's so, Tommy, you're going to have to get near the microphone. This is now the nugget section, and I said, should we do this one or that one? And you just came up with a better word than sub-nugget. What did you say we should call it, Tommy?
The bi-nugget.
Yes, we are going to do a bi-nugget, which again ties into Jurassic Park 3 quite well.
I knew that was coming.
What did you find there, Timmy? I found I think his name is Even Timmy. Like, it's that funny when you watch this movie. It's like, what do you know about dinosaur bones, Timmy? All right.
is Rick Oley in it?
Yeah, I know. Seriously. Okay. All right, so why don't we start with... let's start actually with this conceptual sketch, and then we'll get back, because I feel like we're running perilously close to being rocket-fetted out. so, Steve, you found this, and the write-up was done on the archive actually by Lisa and Vic, although I assume that you guys know a fair amount about this. I'd never heard of it, Steve, until you sent it to me. What is it, Steve?
I'd never heard of it either. It's a conceptual sketch for the sea serpent that Boba Fett rides in the holiday special. And I'll be honest, I still haven't even seen that segment of the holiday special.
Dude,
I just know, seen little clips here and there, but
obviously, it's a concept that was short-lived with the failings of that whole enterprise. But it's a really neat drawing of this crazy creature that he's flying around on. And it's neat that it actually survived. It seems to be like a pretty big piece, too. They had to kind of do a double scan to get the whole image there. But it kind of goes along with, though, that Chewie family that never really materialized. But I just thought it was a neat piece of history because the holiday special did air in November, and it was also Boba Fett's debut, right? So
right. Oh, yeah, it's right around right now. Chris, Gus, or Ron, do you know, is there any chance this made it to a further stage of production than just these drawings, do you think?
I think it's plausible, but I don't think it's probable. I mean, I think, you never know with this stuff, but I haven't seen any evidence of it.
Okay, and that's true. I mean, when I see this, Chris, when I look at these pictures, it really looks like it's drawn on a napkin or stuff. I mean, when we're looking at this, at what phase do you think this was? I mean, it had to be commissioned, right? I mean, do you think this was, what phase of production is this considered?
I mean, they do concept stuff all the time. We'd find people with piles of just drawings and whatnot. You know, it's so easy to get an in-house guy or just a contract guy to come in and do a bunch of drawings, you know, in an afternoon. He's cranked out a ton of this stuff just that's how to get the initial ideas down. So, you know, just a preliminary sketch probably.
I mean, I remember when this came up and putting it on here for them, and it was in Tomar, too, it mentions here. I mean, I would, Gus is right. I mean, I would guarantee you this really, I don't think it ever got off of paper, let's put it that way. Like, right. I would be surprised if it did.
Right.
Kind of cool to see.
It's kind of like Loch Ness Monster.
One of my pet peeves, well, I don't know if pet peeve is, maybe it's too strong, but when people, I always try to call these things conceptual stuff, because sometimes people are like, oh, this is an unproduced toy. It's like, well, I guess technically, yeah, it was never made, you know, but to me, like, the Rocket Flying Boba Fett is an unproduced toy, or that plush Ewok with the what was that one called?
Zephy.
The one. Yeah, Zephy is an unproduced toy. Like, stuff that was really, like, made and then never released, although
right.
I guess that's really an unreleased, not unproduced. But these things, I mean, there's probably so much stuff we don't even know about that was mooted or sketched or talked about and then never made, you know, and this is just kind of an interesting doodle that someone made based on the holiday special that probably never went anywhere, you know, other than this.
It's crazy. All right, well, let's get to our second of our bi-curious nugget is going to be the kit-bashed Boba Fett prototype. Now, Ron touched on this briefly. I don't know about you, Tommy. I like to refer to this era of the archive itself as the marble era. Do you do that too, Tommy?
I definitely do notice the different backgrounds, yeah.
So there was a long time, right, when you first started, Gus, tell me if this is true, where you always use this kind of marble paper background for your entries to the archive, right?
Yep. Yeah, we did. And then we changed it when we moved all the data over to the database, but to kind of have the MySQL database backend. But the problem was we didn't really finish the transition ever. So there's a whole bunch of this stuff that's still out there that has the old background.
Right. Well,
like a time capsule.
Yeah. That's like the double racetrack on the Star Wars card. Like you can't get rid of the marble. That's the charm of the archive. that's the equivalent of vintage. Before like the stupid podcast and all that. so tell me, what is this kit bashed? You know, it's almost like another vocab, but what is this piece? What are these pictures that we see?
Oh, I mean, I just, described before, like, figuring out that the pieces on it were from other figures, which I don't think I'd ever heard before, and making the custom figures. And, kit bashing is a term that model makers use when they take other parts from other stuff and kind of like, especially model kits, that's where the kit comes from, and kind of just bash them together to make something else. So that was kind of where the term came from. I don't know if anyone else ever called it that, but I remember starting to call it that when I figured out it was made from other parts. And right. I think that's what I've used to call it when I entered it on the archive. And I'm looking at it now. Chris beefed it up considerably with some better photos and some more information later on. But when it was first entered on here, it just had a tiny photo, the scan of the insert to the final case, and then the picture from the Collect All 32 store display, which I had, and then just had kind of some information about kitbashing in general, and then what the figure was made up of, and so on and so forth. And I'm not aware of the figure before it was on the archive ever being discussed in a magazine or anything like that. So it was kind of like, I think people were like interested when it was first released, like, oh, Boba Fett. You know, I knew that that figure in that picture in the case was different, but I never really thought about it. And that kind of started a ball rolling of people thinking about that figure, I think. And like, I know we all had one friend who we did a lot of Cincinnati trips, who was obsessed with finding it after he saw it on the archive.
Right.
And he went all over the place asking people about it and never really came up with any good leads to actually find it.
Yeah.
But that's kind of the story of the entry. And like I said, there was a lot more information turned up later, better pictures, especially Cloud City and some of the stuff they turned up from Kenner employees. And Chris went back and expanded it here, where there's he identified a couple of different versions, and it's really worth looking into the history of it all on the archive there, because you can read how they're different. Changed some of the write-up and added some other information on there as well.
Now, in all of your talks with, like, sculptors and stuff, have you ever talked to them about how that firing mechanism worked? Because it's not an L slot or a J slot. It's like a little button.
I believe it's – someone identified it years ago and told me it was from a Shogun Warriors figure.
That's what I thought.
And I thought I identified it – I'm trying to remember. This is years ago in a picture and saying, yeah, that looks like what it is. And I seem to remember we talked to Kenner people about it. I know this friend that I mentioned who – was on the hunt for it. I remember him having some very specific information about the backpack and the firing mechanism. What it was now, I can't remember, but yeah, I believe it's pulled from another toy. A Japanese toy. I think it's a Shogun figure or something.
Most people's first time they saw this was like on the back of the car. And for years, I think that most people thought it was a painting. I always thought it was a painting of completely a drawing. And I think that case, we saw the insert of the case, like, my gosh, that is a real figure, and that painting was just a highly airbrushed version, or maybe just an airbrushed copy of an actual figure. And then later on, we found a spec book, and then there was a lineup of the new 9 figures, you know, making all the 20 back figures, and sure enough, there was that Boba Fett figure. And I don't know if there were multiple ones or if they took it and reworked it. You know, I think it was the Ken Simmons photography that turned up years ago with Cloud City had, and Tom lent us these images to put on the archives. We had the two distinct versions of the Bash figure, but it always seemed like they took it and tweaked the same figure rather than build a second one. But I don't have any proof of that. And they said nothing's ever turned up for those, as far as a real figure goes.
Now, this is I didn't know this question existed, and now that I'm asking it, it must be a stupid question. On the back of a 20-back, that's not a painting? Or, wait, what? I'm looking at it now.
I want to say it's airbrushed over, but I have to go really look at it.
I think it's mostly painting, but yeah, I think that's why we were thrown off, is that it might have started with a photograph, but is mostly airbrushed. But I think that's why a lot of people initially assumed there wasn't really a kitbash piece, because some of the biggest reference was, you know, the 20 backs. You know, that's where people were seeing them in this. You know, and then later when you get the close up of the whole figure, you go, okay, I see it's a figure. But we have on the archive, we have the art images of the artwork of. Neuheisel's collection, so you can take a look and judge for yourself if you think there's any original photograph in that.
Yeah, well, that'll be good for the enhanced version of the podcast.
Because try nugget.
No, I didn't mean to say that it was a photograph painted over it. It was of that style. Like, they took a picture and posed it and sort of like painted it in that exact shape. And then when you saw the real figure, like, oh my gosh, it was just painting of this actual toy. It wasn't just somebody drawing it like a cartoon piece from scratch.
Right. Yeah, no, it's pretty amazing. That is probably the biggest white whale out there, right? I can't imagine a figure that people would want to find more than that. It's got to be...
It'll be a big one. The interesting thing is, it's the kind of thing you would imagine someone saving, you know?
Right.
I mean, one thing you learn looking for this stuff over the years is that a lot was saved, you know, especially, you know, things like the Rocket Fire and Boba Fett. People saved those, like... This may have been tossed at some point, who knows, but I wouldn't, you know, at this point, it wouldn't shock me if it's sitting out there and someone saved it. Like, who knows, you know.
But it's certainly true that not a lot of hacked-together kitbash things have really survived, so that's consistent with that. You know, you just don't see that many handmade models
right.
that have turned up over the years. But hopefully someone has it. We'll see.
You don't hate, only the unloved hate, the unloved and the unnatural. The unloved and the unnatural.
Anyway, so have you guys come up with any good unloved and unnatural Boba Fett items that you would like to showcase or talk about?
I got one.
Oh, thank you, Tommy.
On page 111 of the second edition of the Tomarts Guide, they have household items, and they show a Boba Fett hanger for clothes that you'd mount on your wall. And I looked for that thing for years just because I thought it was crazy before I realized that it was just something thrown in to, like, root out people who were stealing content from the Tomart book. I think those things are awesome. Like, next to it is an Admiral Akbar clothes hanger.
Oh, man.
Wow.
Like, there's Fett, there's 3PO, Vader, and the Imperial Guard. And
wow.
I don't know if those are, like, internal photos from Adam Joseph or what, but those things are awesome. I would buy those.
Now, this is the problem, right? Because you can't scan anything from Tomarts, not even to scan them to say, isn't it great how they do these weird things about scanning them, right? How is anyone ever going to see this, Tommy?
They can use their imagination. Or you could make an argument that it's fair use for educational purposes.
Hey, yeah.
Hey, that's why we hang out with the lawyer.
I can draw something on it, and you can claim it's parody.
yeah, like Paris
that's
Hilton.
That's the ticket right there.
All right, good. So, Tommy, can you please scan that in or something or other or find it? Because I've never even heard of those.
Oh, they're awesome. I think it's definitely unloved in that it was so unloved it wasn't even made.
Right. Wow, Boba Fett, fake clothes hangers. Now, see, is that a collectible in and of itself? I think it is.
Yeah.
I buy it.
All right. Anyone else have one they want to jump in with?
Yeah. You know, it's really hard with Boba Fett because, like, if anything, he's the most overloved character in Star Wars.
Of course.
But I would say the Topps candy head. So
Ooh.
I was just, like, checking out on eBay. I saw an auction end for – it was actually 5 candy heads, but they were about $1 a piece. So it was a vintage item, Topps Empire Strikes Back era – and the candy head goes for about $1 or $2. And you know, it's like one of the few vintage Fett pieces that I don't think anyone really cares.
Yeah, and those things are great. I mean, I have very vivid memories of playing with those. I can taste the candy. Ooh, that's what we can do for our next archive party.
Hey.
Yeah. Yeah. Couldn't be any worse than the 3PO cereal.
Yeah. That's a great unloved item, too, you know, because it's just one color. I think if it just had a little bit of color on it, other than just the flat green, people maybe would bite, but it's just so cheap, you know. But, yeah, it's an Empire era. All right. How about you, Chris? Do you have any unloved Fett items?
I know Gus loves his Boba Fett cake pan, and so he loves that. Yeah. But I would think that was probably another thing that doesn't get too much press.
Oh, absolutely. Tell us a little bit more about the Boba Fett.
Gus could probably tell you more. Actually, I think the cooler unloved item would be the underoos.
Okay.
That's sort of semi-loved. Oh, yeah. You know, there's a certain amount of people that do go for the underoos.
It's probably best that those are unloved.
Yes. I think I told you guys the story that I had to get the Chewbacca underoos, but I specifically asked my wife to get them for me for my birthday, and I said, you have to get them AFA'd because I'm not going to have anyone thinking that I took them out or anything. So I proudly have, like, the only AFA'd, you know, like, they need to be absolutely acrylically sealed. But, yeah. No, those are great, too, because you have to divide underoos between, you know, two different kinds, you know, like the ones that imitate the costume and the ones that are just the pictures of the person. But you know what? Look at that, Steve. Have you looked at the Boba Fett underoos lately?
No, not in a while.
how it's late. Right? Yes.
Not since this morning.
Not since last night.
Not since I put them on.
But they're in the washing machine, all right?
Yeah. The colors are actually kind of kitbashy colors. Like, it's a really strong yellow. And it's kind of a darker green than you actually associate with Boba Fett. And the blue's a little bit lighter. I don't know.
Is there a store display for them where they have, like, the kid wearing Boba Fett underoos standing in front of Boba Fett? And then, like, the kid wearing Vader underoos standing in front of Vader? It's just disturbing.
In the not-so-distant future on a planet called Earth, it's underoos.
Star Wars Boba Fett is here. That means Darth Vader's always near. C-3PO is lots of style. And R2-D2 just makes me smile. Star Wars underoos are here, yeah! Something out of sight in underwear.
Don't be so ridiculous, R2. Underoos are for Earthlings.
Oh, yeah. All right, so Gus, tell us more about the cake pan then.
Yeah, I mean, I actually think if you look at some recent eBay auctions, there's actually some love for the cake pan. It actually still does okay, for me, it was the report from the Star Wars Generation that we talked about earlier, that fanzine that came out in the early 90s. That thing, it was hilarious that, you know, that John Snyder wrote this fanzine that was really popular. Until Lucasfilm lawyers got a hold of it, and then they made him like an editor for The Insider. But anyway, in that he had a story where they talked about the Boba Fett cake pan and just made, you know, just jokes about the Boba Fett cake pan. I just thought, oh man, that's just such a ridiculously cheesy thing, you know. And so, you know, that's for me, I think the attraction of Boba Fett cake pan was that article and that because the if you ever get that fanzine, it has lots of kind of references to collectibles in it, and the Boba Fett cake pan's mentioned in that. So that's, I think, part of the draw. And actually, we use our cake pan. We've made multiple Boba Fett cakes with ours. So I actually don't even own a mint one with the paper piece in it. I just use the cake pans.
Yeah, I see that. That's where you get into trouble, Steve. At a certain point, you know, things go from unloved to cult, and it's like,
yeah, that's true.
I mean, by the time we're done, the fun poncho is definitely going to be firmly entrenched in cult and not just unloved. Whereas some things will stay unloved, like I think the candy head will stay unloved,
probably. Yeah.
But the cake pan's pretty sweet. Was that everybody, Ron? Did I ask you if you have an unloved Fett item?
I'm at a loss, so I'm just gonna. I'm at a loss for Boba Fett items, so I'm just going to mention that I think Dash Rendar items are unloved to a reasonable degree. I think that's a cult item on the horizon, Dash Rendar items.
I would actually buy Dash Rendar items now.
He might be in the new movies, man. He's a big, you know, popular cult item.
Yeah, no.
But it's so, what was that, 97?
Yeah. 96. Yeah.
I would totally buy some of that stuff now, just for laughs.
Yeah.
He was like Han Solo, but not Han Solo.
He had awesome shoulder pads.
Hey, yeah, the pads, the armor.
Yes, he was Han Solo in catcher's gear.
Yeah.
That's right. I think even one image, he kind of looked like Kevin Costner or something. He reminded me of him. It's just now I'm picturing that.
Did Jordan post for him or something?
Yeah, Jordan used to say he posed for him. Characters based on him.
Oh, man.
Well, it is an anagram, Dash Rendar, Jordan Hambrough. You just do the math.
It's like the name, too. It's like you can picture marketing people around a table. Like, we need something exciting and edgy. How about Dash Rendar?
Yeah, it's like that that Simpsons, like that Simpsons joke. Like Dash Rendar, but, you know, something not as lame. And then he like leaves
Poochie.
The room.
It's like Poochie on the Simpsons, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Totally market-tested character.
Dash Rendar, he, like, killed that game for me because, like, the rest of it was cool, but he's just so generic and so bland. You could tell they were just trying to make a cross between Boba Fett and Han Solo. And
his like, the ship he rides around in, too, is, like, the Millennium Falcon, but not the Millennium Falcon.
Yeah, right, yeah.
That's not canon because it's in Hope now.
Oh, right. Yeah, it's like the
Hangover Mos Eisley now in the special editions. They added.
Oh, God.
That's right.
Yeah. This is the Centennial Hawk. It's really good. Oh, man, yeah. I do like Prince Shizor, Prince Scissors, or whatever his name is. He was kind of cool.
Actually, the Leia from Shadows of the Empire is one of – they had a poll, and it was one of the most crested, like, figures or something a while back, which is just weird.
Wasn't she dressed in the bounty hunter disguise, though, from Jedi? I mean, it was just a normal...
No, no, he gives her, like, a gown, I think. In the novel, which I actually read because I used to be, you know, a geek.
Nothing wrong with Shadows of the Empire, man. It's a good book.
It was like...
Troy Denner? Like, is he the guy who wrote it?
I think is why people liked it.
Oh.
So there you go. So I think that's probably why people wanted to see that in action figure form.
I see. Yeah. Well, I mean, Steve, have I ever told the story of the Shadows of the Empire Chewbacca on the Kivecast before?
The Snuva?
Yeah.
I think you may have made reference to it.
Snuva?
Yeah, you've mentioned it before.
Okay, because yeah. that was how stupid I was. I spent a lot of energy driving all over Boston trying to find a Snuva. I was convinced, because I couldn't find Snuva, you know, I had every other Chewbacca ever made, I thought. And I was like, I just can't find Snuva. And that was when my brother, Lobart, he was like, you know, there's this site called eBay. And if you get this,
right, yeah.
And Genesis. I remember typing it up, and that was the first thing I ever got from eBay, and I bought it on my brother's account. I didn't even get it for myself, and I set it up, and it was like the second iteration of the Chewseum. I remember honestly having this thought in my head, my Chewbacca collection is complete.
I tried to buy a Dash Rendar hard copy from Ron once, but it was already sold.
Oh, ooh. Man.
Oh, that's so, when we had all the hard copies. That's when we I think I had a huge find of Power of the Force 2 hard copies. They're all painted.
Huh.
And we got them back to the hotel. You know, we bought them from somebody and we got them to the hotel. And we're on the bed and, like, one of our friends was sitting there. And a lot of the hard copies had guns and some were hard copy and some were plastic guns. And he's sitting there on the bed and he's trying to figure out which are hard copies and which are plastics. So, of course, he's bending them to see which ones will break.
Oh, no.
Because the ones that break are the good ones, right? So... He bends one, breaks. He goes, that's a hard copy. Breaks, that's a hard copy. Bends another, we're like, no!
Wow. It's like testing for wrenches.
I'm not even lying. Exactly.
I totally remember that. It was hilarious.
I was like, are you kidding me? He's like, I can't tell if they're hard copies or not. I'm like, well, don't break them.
Well, I just looked on eBay. So Snuva, one sold recently for $1.73.
Oh. Hey. I would have paid 50 back then. Oh.
Sky, this is something you should do, Sky.
But
like,
Snuva is twice as good as a cop's Boba Fett candy.
Exactly. Thank you, Chris.
What's that say?
I know.
Sky, you should do an episode on the early days of eBay. I was talking about this with someone the other day, and it's pretty funny to even think about eBay in the days before pictures.
Yeah.
Like written descriptions.
That sounds awesome.
You could leave feedback for anybody back in the day. It was just like the wild and woolly days.
Oh, that's awesome.
I got feedback based on another site that I didn't even belong to. They left me negative feedback, and I dealt with him on this site, and he ripped me off. Like, I don't even know who you are. I don't belong
to
this site.
Yeah, it used to just, you know, it's funny to think about.
Yeah, well, I remember sitting there thinking, like, am I ever going to get this Snuva, you know? I thought it would just never happen.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Tommy.
I remember an auction once that was, like, prototype early bird Star Wars figures, very rare prototype, like, 99 cents or something. No picture. And part of me now, like, years later, wishes I had just put in the dollar to see what it was. Like, just get them in the mail.
Yeah.
People forget that, you know, 90% of the stuff on eBay when it started seemed like they had no pictures. You're just, like, scrolling through lists of stuff, you know. It's just crazy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that if it weren't 12:20 a.m., I'd say we should launch right into it. But that sounds like our, you know, our next maybe roundtable. You know what's funny, Steve? I think... when we put out this episode, you know, people are going to give feedback and they're going to be like, yeah, the Disney stuff was great and it was cool hearing about Fett, but just talking about Shadows of the Empire, that was really just awesome.
So I'm still looking for a prototype Shadows of the Empire Galoob stuff. That stuff is hard to find. I can find the original trilogy stuff and the prequel stuff, but the Shadows of the Empire stuff, it's not out there.
Yeah, it's not. I mean... I have a couple Shadows pieces that I'll even admit to owning still, like the Shizor's ship, blanking on what it was called, but I have a few
Verigo.
That's it. Virago or Verigo or whatever. There's some sketches and presentation boards I have of that. I always loved it because it's an unproduced vehicle. I mean, they were designing it, and there's a mock-up they made of it and stuff, but they never made it. But I always love to find that ship, and I have a couple, presentation boards and sketches from it. But that's about the only Shadows thing. I have a couple also figure mock-ups, but there's some Boba Fett card, different kind of card designs and things that actually look better than the whole Power of the Force 2 cards. The ones they rejected seem to be better than the ones they ran with.
Right.
So there's some cool Shadows prototypes actually that they were considering. Unfortunately, they ended up going with stuff that wasn't as good as the discarded ideas.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is true. Where else are you going to have lengthy discussions about Shadows of the Empire prototypes? I mean, it's true because, I don't think really even modern collectors – it's almost like Bendems or something, in a strange way they seem to fall between the cracks. Like, I would definitely get excited about I have a couple like Snuva Proofs now, or I call them Pruvas. I have a couple Snuva Proofs, and I'm just really excited about those. And the Power of the Force 2 stuff, is cool, but there's something about that Shadows of the Empire stuff that's really cool, and Boba Fett's in it to kind of bring it all full circle. And it's the official plot of Episode 7.
As long as Captain Panaka's in it, I'm happy.
That's right, yeah. It's Captain Panaka versus and IG-88. They team up. Man, Steve. Well, what do we think? Have we taken enough of these good folks' time?
It's been quite a night, for sure.
Yeah, it has been. We sort of wanted to have a feedback section. Is there anything beyond having a early days of eBay? Is there anything else you guys, being sort of, actual important people with the archive, anything you'd like to see happen more in the show? Or why don't we start with Tommy?
I am enjoying this podcast because usually I listen to the podcast and feel like chiming in, but then feel like an idiot as I just say my comment to the living room and remember right. That it's a podcast and you're not there. So this is a much easier format for me.
All right. Cool. How about you, Gus? Anything as the sort of the grand moth of this whole ship?
Well, I agree with Tommy on, I actually like the interactive format. I actually think that is pretty cool. I know we've always done interviews in the past, but having a group of people, you can really riff and bounce ideas. And I think it's kind of fun. New idea. I don't know if you've done that before, that many people together, but
no, I was terrified doing this because I thought it was going to be the entire time of all of us just going, oh no, you, but as always, Chris is very helpful with his advice. And he said, make sure you have it. So you look at my thing and I say, Chris, how has the market changed for Rocket Fett throughout the years? Gus, last L shot sold for 2,000. Whatever. Like it didn't wind up being the same as I wrote it out, but keeping it clear. But yeah, and I think we should do these more.
Yeah, it's been good.
Yeah.
I also think you should have a regular series of Mark Salati telling an uncomfortable story from his life.
Okay. Awesome. Well, Steve, I think that probably should be it. Yes. I would say, yeah, we'll maybe try and do it again. Maybe six is too many, but maybe we'll try and like little things of here and four. Maybe just kind of pick up a topic as time goes on.
Sure.
I think six is too many, Steve. They'll record it and just send it to me. I'll edit it and I'll put it up. We'll have to deal with us. You can just talk about all that stuff. Cool. Well, why don't we say a big thanks and a big wampa wampa to our esteemed panel.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
All right. Thanks, Guy and Steve.
Hey. Wait. Tommy has a final thing.
I had a final thought on the Disney Lucas film purchase.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah. Disney paid $4 billion for Lucasfilm. Last year alone, they made $3 billion on their Princesses line.
Oh, wow.
So that just goes to show you the size of the companies.
Wow.
That's a lot of money.
One additional thing I'd say that kind of tie a little bit to vintage and Disney. So if you reflect on how much you've spent on Star Wars, one of the interesting ramifications of Disney buying Star Wars is you can now buy stock in Disney and actually own a piece of Star Wars. Like, it's the first time ever you actually make money in some sense off Star Wars. I thought, that's kind of profound. Like, I'm going to go buy some Disney stock just to say I own a piece of, however small of Star Wars, you know, it's a small snippet of Star Wars. But that I thought was kind of interesting.
And the other part of that is that because Lucas is now giving all of his money to charity, you can say that every dime you've paid to Star Wars, either buying new figures, seeing the movies, paying the convention fees, all ultimately went to education. So essentially,
I buy all my stuff second market, man.
Yeah, all right, you do, but you know.
But on that, just on that point, though, like I don't know the details of the deal, but he made a lot of money over the years. Isn't this the amount of money of the selling the company, but the profits he made over the years? I thought went in, like, he did other, may have done other things with it. I'm not sure of the details of how much he made over the years on Star Wars, but I didn't think the deal with Disney was all the profits he's made on Star Wars at all time. I thought they'd made quite a bit on Pepsi deal and all that kind of stuff.
Right. Well, I'm just trying to justify, you know, the fact that I still buy a lot of stuff from Star Wars first market. So thanks, Gus, for moving my jerk. Oh, awesome. Yeah, no, this is great. I think what we should do, too, is just, this is nice and easy. We could do this. Maybe next time we do it, we'll, like, talk for more beforehand to get more of the easy flow going, kind of getting used to it. That'll be fun.
Sounds good.
Cool. Well, nice womp womp, everybody. I'll let you know when it's all up, and we'll see you around.
All right, guys. Thanks.
Thanks, guys.
See ya.
Cool. Wampa wampa.
Adios.
This podcast is not endorsed by Lucasfilm Limited, Hasbro Toys, or 20th Century Fox, and is intended for entertainment and information purposes only. The official Star Wars site can be found at www.starwars.com. The official Hasbro site can be found at www.hasbro.com. Star Wars, all names and sounds of Star Wars characters and any other Star Wars related items are registered trademarks and or copyrights of Lucasfilm Limited or their respective copyright and trademark holders. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of the Star Wars Collector's Archive, unless otherwise indicated.